I know you're out there. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. And then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
This Week in Radical History, for the week starting December 1st.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, hey!
So starting on December 1st, 1842, Philip Spencer was the first U.S. naval officer condemned for mutiny and was hung for it. He wanted to take over the ship, the USS Summers, and become a pirate. Arr, matey, don't we all?
Yo!
Yo ho!
Yo ho! I'm tired of life, folks!
I love this song!
Also on December 1st, 1899, Robert Welsh discovers there are commies under every bed in America and grows up to found the Wacky John Birch Society, an ultra-right-wing organization based in my home state, Appleton, Wisconsin. Also on December 1st, 1914, Fame Labor Song, Solidarity Forever, written by IWW songwriter Rolf Chaplin, for a hunger march to be led by anarchist Lucy Parsons in Chicago. Here is part of that song.
The union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong. They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Also on December 1st, 1919, Alexander Berkman, Emma Goldman, and 200-plus other anarchists, labor militants, and radicals are forced to leave the land of the free, deported to Russia on a rust bucket Buford labeled the Death Ship. As then, through 9/11 now, when protesting the Iraq invasion, subject you to arrest and labeled as traitor. America believes we have free speech only if no one practices it. Also on that day, in 1955, Rosa Parks, an African-American, gets busted refusing to give her seat in front of the bus to a white man and is forced to sit in the back in Montgomery, Alabama. This sets off a successful year-long bus boycott by blacks and sparks a civil rights movement for the next decade. Despite the popular understanding of this event, there were a few other successful bus boycotts years previous to the Rosa Parks efforts. Also on that date in 1968 in Vietnam, an American C-123 develops engine troubles, lightens its load by spraying a full tank of defoliant over two South Vietnamese towns, those are allies by the way, causing deaths and widespread birth defects for generations. A couple more items for December 1st, 1968. Public release of the Rights of Conflict, commonly called the Walker Report. They were nationally charged with a study and reporting on the urban riots to investigate the convention week disturbances of the Democratic National Convention. They reviewed over 20,000 pages of statements from 3,437 witnesses and participants, 180 hours of film, and over 12,000 still photographs. The Walker Report attached the label, Police Riot, during the event of the Chicago riots during the DNC. Now we need an equivalent investigation into police riots during the RNC this past September. Lastly, for December 1, 1999, World Trade Organization delegates, after a warm welcome yesterday in Seattle, are unable to meet because of the protesters. Last night, a civil emergency was declared and a curfew imposed. Today, the downtown area is cordoned off by police and National Guard units are brought in. Shoppers flee the malls. Solidarity protests occur around the world as well, including London, Paris, New York, and San Francisco. This week in radical history for December 2nd, 1954, Senate censures Joe McCarthy, Senator Republican from Wisconsin, for, quote, conduct that tends to bring the Senate into dishonor and dispute, unquote. The censure finally ends Joe's circus, now that the media had gotten all the mileage out of it could, and ends his probes into alleged communist infiltration. Many states, however, continue to do their own investigations. Several southern states later convened their own anti-American activity committee meetings and turned it into apparatus for harassing and jailing civil rights supporters. Quoting a right-wing mayor, "You hear about constitutional rights, free speech, and the free press. Every time I hear these words, I say to myself, that man is a Red. You never hear real Americans talk like that." The Reds obviously hate our freedom. Also on December 2, 1956, the boat Granma, with 8,200 Fidel Castro, head off to fight against Batista and the American Mafia. They'll eventually succeed, as most of the Cuban people are unhappy with U.S. Mafia control of their lands and start massive civil disobedience campaigns that support Castro's efforts. A couple of quick more factoids for December 2nd, like in 1970 in Philadelphia, when the FBI admits that they have infiltrated black student groups at 13 campuses. Let freedom ring. Also on that date in 1980, El Salvador, four Catholic missionary women are killed by U.S. government-backed death squads. The U.S. government wants to claim that the Catholic missionaries probably were toting guns for leftist guerrillas. Nuns with guns. Also in 1980, the International Human Rights Body finds that the U.S., Canada, and several Latin American countries guilty of cultural and physical genocide in their present-day treatment of Indian populations. Also in 1983, convention prohibiting inhumane weapons comes into force. The U.S. is the largest manufacturer and seller of weapons, including biological and chemical weapons of mass destruction, and refused to sign treaties outlawing landmines. Answering the time-old question, who would Jesus bomb? Apparently anyone that can pay U.S. weapons dealers enough money. Lastly, for December 2nd, 1999, World Trade Organization Day 3. Delegates try to meet as a core 50-block area downtown Seattle is declared off-limits to protesters, and most businesses in the area are closed. The civil emergency remains in effect. Over 225 protesters arrested and held overnight and denied access to lawyers and phone calls. For the second night in a row, police and protesters clash in nearby Capitol Hill area, where many residents are gassed and shot with rubber bullets. Protests continue in other U.S. cities and around the world as well, including 6,000 in the Philippines. Seattle media begins to blame confrontations and acts of vandalism on the Eugene, Oregon anarchist group. A message from the Eugene anarchist published in the paper criticized unions and other WTO opponents as part of the glue holding the rotting order together. It is time to create a new world from the ashes after the ruined one. Fight back and don't get caught. Excerpt from the Seattle Times, 1999. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist and a spy is liberal. We march together. This week in radical history for December 3rd, 1857, Joseph Conrad, author of the book Secret Agent, is born. The book Secret Agent expressed forms of religious fanaticism that he contends connected with dangers of both foreign imperialism and the lower classes. However, you can see a movie loosely based on this great book called Secret Agent, starring with an excellent performance from Robin Williams as a nihilistic bomber. That is Secret Agent. It came out in about 1998. Also, sadly, on December 3rd, 1984, in India, in the early morning of December 3rd, a Union Carbine pesticide-producing plant leaked a highly toxic cloud onto the densely populated region of central India, of which about 800,000 people lived at the time. 2,000 died immediately, 300,000 were injured, and as many as 8,000 had died since. Devastating after-effects follows for years. The U.S., always good at protecting their corporate paymasters, blocks extradition of Union Carbine officials facing criminal prosecution in India. This week in radical history for December 4th, 1838, Democracy in Action, the Buckshot War. Angry mob assembles in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, when both Whigs and Democrats claim a majority in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Militia, equipped with buckshot, appear on the scene. A few Whig votes hastily change to the Democratic side, and the war is officially over. God bless American democracy. Also on December 4, 1969, Black Panther activists Fred Hampton, 21, and Mark Clark, 22, as well as two others are murdered in their beds by Chicago police with the complicity of the FBI. This makes at least 19 Black Panther leaders killed in the past 18 months. You're about to hear a four-minute communique from the Weather Underground, clearly stated in the documentary on the Weather Underground, that it was the state murder of the Black Panther leaders Hampton and Clark that showed the Weather Underground people they needed to step up to more direct violence and confrontation against the FBI to at least draw police resources away from the Black Panthers and anti-war groups. Here is that recorded statement from the Weather Underground known as Communique Number 1.
Hello, this is Brandine Dillon. I'm granting you a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. All over the world, people fighting American imperialism look to America's youth to use our strategic position behind enemy lines to join forces in the destruction of the empire. Black people have been fighting almost alone for years. We've known that our job is to lead white kids into armed revolution. We never intended to spend the next 5 or 25 years of our lives in jail. Ever since SDS became revolutionary, we've been trying to show how it is possible to overcome the frustration and impotence that comes from trying to reform this system. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Tens of thousands have learned that protests and marches don't do it. Revolutionary violence is the only way. Now we are adopting the classic guerrilla strategy of the Viet Cong and the urban guerrilla strategy of the Tupamaros to our own situation here in the most technically advanced country in the world. Che taught us that revolutionaries move like fish in the sea. The alienation and contempt that young people have for this country has created the ocean for this revolution. The hundreds and thousands of young people who demonstrated in the 60s against the war and for civil rights grew to hundreds of thousands in the past few weeks, actively fighting Nixon's invasion of Cambodia and the attempted genocide against black people. The insanity of American justice has added to its list of atrocities 6 blacks killed in Augusta, 2 in Jackson, and 4 white Kent State students, making thousands more into revolutionaries. The parents of privileged kids have been saying for years that the revolution was a game for us. But the war and the racism of this society show that it is too f***ed up. We will never live peacefully under this system. This was totally true of those who died in the New York townhouse explosion. The third person who was killed there was Terry Robbins, who led the first rebellion at Kent State less than 2 years ago. The 12 weathermen who were indicted for leading last October's riots in Chicago have never left the country. Terry is dead. Linda was captured by a pagan former. But the rest of us move freely in and out of every city and youth scene in this country. They're not hiding out, but we're invisible. There are several hundred members of the Weatherman Underground, and some of us face more years in jail than the 50,000 deserters and draft dodgers now in Canada. Already many of them are coming back to join us in the underground, or to return to the man's army and tear it up from inside along with those who never left. We fight in many ways. Dope is one of our weapons. The laws against marijuana mean that millions of us are outlaws long before we actually split. Guns and grass are united in the youth underground. Freaks are revolutionaries, and revolutionaries are freaks. If you want to find us, this is where we are. In every tribe, commune, dormitory, farmhouse, barracks, and townhouse, where kids are making love, smoking dope, and loading guns, fugitives from American justice are free to go. For Diana Alton, Ted Gold, and Terry Robbins, and for all the revolutionaries who are still on the move here, there has been no question for a long time now. We will never go back. Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice. This is the way we celebrate the example of Eldridge Cleaver and H. Rapp Brown and all black revolutionaries who first inspired us by their fight behind enemy lines for the liberation of their people. Never again will they fight alone.
Never again. Also in 1973, Abbie Hoffman and the Chicago Seven and their attorney are found guilty of contempt. Abbie Hoffman would say about the proceeding, quote, "When I appeared in the Chicago courtroom, I wanted to be tried not because I supported the Vietnamese Communist National Liberation Front, which I do, but because I have long hair. Not because I support the Black Liberation Movement, but because I smoke dope. Not because I'm against capitalist system, but because I think property eats. Not because I believe in student power, but that schools should be destroyed. Not because I'm against corporate liberalism, but because I think people should do whatever the fuck they want. Finally, I want to be tried for having a good time and not for being serious." Abbie Hoffman.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس
قزح. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. The massacre at Standing Rock continues and escalates, and President Obama, true to form, does nothing, just as he has done nothing positive in 8 years on the Palestinian issue, which we will examine in more detail in a minute. But first, I want to read excerpts from Nadia Aliyah's incisive article in Mondawise, where once again a Palestinian journalist sees the parallel struggles of Native Americans and Palestinians. She writes, "One of the accusations most frequently lobbed at BDS activists, boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, is that boycotts are divisive. Apparently, they drive a wedge in society, pitting community members against each other. Our response has consistently been that the division is already there between those who support justice and equal rights for all and the Zionists who advocate ethno-religious supremacy and the disenfranchisement of the Palestinian people. And since our country, our government, our tax dollars support Zionism, we are inevitably involved in the oppression. In other words, there is no default position of neutrality, which BDS threatens. The polarity already exists. It is only being brought into prominence by boycotts, which allow people to act upon their conscience. By default, meaning by not engaging in BDS, we are siding with the oppressor, whereas the targeted boycott of Israeli products and of companies that benefit from Israelis' violation of the human rights of the Palestinian people allows us to switch sides so as to be on the side of justice. Today, as the U.S. is fast becoming more openly polarized around various political developments not directly related to Palestinian justice, we are seeing a number of calls for boycotts and divestment, and a national embrace of boycotts by both conservative and progressive groups. Again, boycotts are not polarizing the people engaging in them. Rather, these are groups and individuals with strong opinions about certain issues who find boycotts to be a useful tool in their rejection of what they consider unethical, unjust, unacceptable. Thus we see that the water protectors, the opponents of the North Dakota Access Pipeline, DAPL, are calling for divestment from banks that fund the pipeline. And people around the nation are withdrawing their money from these banks and placing them in credit unions or smaller banks not involved in financing the pipeline. The divestment itself is not viewed as divisive. Rather, it is an action of people who understand that their money would otherwise support the side they oppose on an issue they feel very strongly about. The struggle between the pipeline and the Standing Rock Sioux Nation would exist anyway. It is not the call for taking out one's money from certain banks that somehow caused the confrontation. That call clearly articulates the impetus behind the calls for divestment put out by BDS activists for justice in Palestine. The community is sending a message to companies that we do not approve of the projects in which they invest our money. Progressives are definitely not the only group calling for boycotts. Various conservative groups, including the American Family Association and the Concerned Women of America, have called for a boycott of Target stores over their LGBTQ-friendly policy, which welcomes transgender team members and guests to use the restroom or fitting room facility that corresponds with their gender identity. Concerned Women of America wrote, "At Concerned Women for America, we know we can't just vote with a ballot. We must vote with our wallets. Our hope is that Target will hear our vote clear and loud this holiday season." And to give just one more recent example, Trump supporters are calling for a boycott of the Broadway show Hamilton after its cast read a statement to Mike Pence, Trump's elected vice president, following a performance he attended. Apparently, 'tis the season to boycott. At the same time, there is a flurry of legislation in many U.S. states against boycotts, sponsored by Zionists seeking to delegitimize BDS. The legislation has already been challenged and defeated as anti-constitutional in a few states, notably Maryland and Virginia. But bills are still being proposed, which will be discussed and voted on when the legislative sessions open again in January. To challenge such lawfare, legal allies such as Palestine Legal, the National Lawyers Guild, and the Center for Constitutional Rights are arguing that boycotts qualify as our First Amendment right to freedom of expression. A very helpful article in the Harvard Law Review points out that the Supreme Court has long held that boycotts to bring about political, economic, and social change, like boycotts for Palestinian rights, are a form of expression protected by the First Amendment. This was established when the Supreme Court reviewed the case of the NAACP boycott of white-owned businesses to pressure city officials to meet demands for racial equality and integration. The court recognized that political boycotts involve a range of expressive activity and rely on the First Amendment freedoms of speech, assembly, association, and petition. Thus, when a bill advocates legal repercussions for engaging in boycotts, that bill is infringing on citizens' First Amendment rights. Indeed, our rights are coming under attack from various angles. As Garrett Epps, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Baltimore, noted in the morning after the 2016 presidential elections, there is hardly a provision of the Bill of Rights or later amendments Trump did not explicitly promise to override, from First Amendment freedom of the press and religion to Fourth Amendment freedom from unreasonable search and seizures, to Sixth Amendment right to counsel, to 14th Amendment birthright, citizenship, and equal protection, and 15th Amendment voting rights. Rather than being divisive then, will boycotts become the grassroots movement that unifies this country as our constitutional rights come under further attack? As more people vote with their wallets and grow to better appreciate the accessibility, but also the legality of boycotts, we need to understand that now is the time to deal a blow to challenges against this strategy. Boycotts are legal. They are protected by our First Amendment right to free speech and freedom of expression, and they can be targeted at department stores with liberal policies, as well as at companies that profit from the violation of human rights and the desecration of indigenous lands from Standing Rock to Palestine. We cannot allow Zionists, be they Democrats or Republicans, to abrogate our constitutional rights so as to further shield Israel from accountability. That was an excerpt from an article in Mondawise, written by Nadia Aliyah. And now on to our feature presentation. This morning we take a long look at the Obama legacy concerning the Palestinian-Israeli struggle from the point of view of Palestinian-Canadian attorney Diana Boutu. The following is a speech she gave at Tufts University on November 16th. It is moderated by Tufts professor Tom Aboud.
Diana Boutu is a Palestinian lawyer and analyst, and among a handful of people in the international community who know just about, who are the top echelon of legal minds and scholars and analysts on the question of Palestine and Israel-Palestine. And tonight she's going to be talking about the legacy of the Obama administration and maybe new legacies to come, but properly historicized within the, I think, the recent political history of the Bush administration and that and those sets of legacies. Diana served on the Palestinian negotiating team, the Palestinian government's negotiating team from 2000 to 2005. She was the only woman involved in the negotiations. And she later worked in Mahmoud Abbas's office. She now works as an independent lawyer and is a policy advisor and to a Palestinian think tank by the name of
Shabaka.
Thank you. Wanted to get that right. What we'll do is, as I said before, we'll have plenty of time for question and answer. But for just this moment, please help me in welcoming our esteemed guest, Diana Boutu.
I hope everybody can hear me. Yes, I don't need to shout. Great. All right. First, thank you very much, Tom, for the invitation, and thank you all for coming. It's wonderful to see so many friendly faces again. The last time I spoke in this very hall was, I think, 2010 or maybe 2011. So it's been quite some time, and it's wonderful to be back. So. You know, now that the election results are in, I was hoping to hear a collective groan. maybe this really isn't Massachusetts. Anyway, I think it's time for us to really step back and look at what it is that President-elect Trump is going to be coming into office with, and what the legacy of President Obama is and will go down as. And when I was thinking about what Obama's legacy is going to be on this issue, I think it's important for us to first keep in mind what it is that President Obama inherited not only on the eve of his election, but after he came to office. And there are a number of things that we have to keep in mind. The first is that Obama came into office the tail end of the 2008-2009 attack on Gaza, an attack in which the Israelis began to use some unprecedented levels of weaponry and force on Palestinians, in which half of the people who were killed were children under the age of 18 and women. And President Obama had chose during that period of time because this was the tail end of 2008 and up until 2009, not to speak to the issue of the attack on Gaza, because he said that only one president speaks at a time, and that it wasn't really his position to do any speaking. Now, of course, he did speak on a whole bunch of other issues that were pressing during that period of time, but he remained silent on the issue of Gaza, and I'll explain why that becomes important very shortly. The second thing that President Obama inherited was something that obviously predates him, which was the Hamas-Fatah split. The Hamas-Fatah split being the ousting of Fatah from the Gaza Strip, the split between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and the continued split between those two. And the third thing that he inherited was something to come along not too far after he was elected, which is Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, why is that important? Prime Minister Netanyahu is the prime minister who has, A, served as the longest prime minister in Israel's history, and B, he will go down as being one of the most racist prime ministers in Israel's history, with everything from promoting settlement activity to talking about Palestinians voting in droves, and then ramping up demolitions and so on. And the fourth thing that Obama inherited was, again, not too long after he became president, was the Goldstone Report, a report in which Israel was rebuked for its actions in the Gaza Strip, the 2008-2009 actions. And then lastly, and one of the most important, is that he inherited the exchange of letters between the Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, who was there and still alive at the time, and the U.S. President Bush. And this letter was a letter in which, for the first time in U.S. history, there was a movement away from condemning all of Israel's settlements to a view that Israel's settlements would now need to be accommodated. Now, why are all of these elements so significant? The elements are so significant, each one of these elements is so significant, because on the eve of when President Obama came into office, there were some actions that he undertook that indicated that he was going to somehow change course and undo the policies that had been done under the Bush years. And some of those actions were, first, if some of you may or may not recall, the very first phone call that he made as president was to Mahmoud Abbas. The reason that was significant was when President Obama was inaugurated, by that point in time, Mahmoud Abbas's term had actually expired. It had come to an end. He was elected in 2005. His term expired in 2009. And when Obama came into office, what he was signaling to the Palestinians was that, A, I'm going to be dealing with this issue, and B, I still recognize that Mahmoud Abbas is your elected president, even though his term had expired. And that becomes significant because it sets into motion all of the other elements that continue to be at play to today. The second thing that President Obama did was, very quickly on, he appointed Senator George Mitchell to come in into Palestine and to serve as sort of a mediator. And the reason that this was significant was that if you think of where President Bush had taken the bilateral process of negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, it was completely torn apart. We were following something called the roadmap. Even that was now in tatters. And instead, it looked as though, with the appointment of Senator Mitchell, that he was going to take a path of not pressing for bilateral negotiations as had been done in the past, but instead look to conflict resolution rather than conflict management, something that the Bush administration had been focusing on. The third thing that he had done was that, if you recall, this is all early on in his presidency, when the Israelis announced their first set of new expansions of settlements in East Jerusalem. President Obama's administration, he didn't do it himself, came out condemning the settlements and the settlement expansion. So here you have, in a period of 2009, within a few short months, a 1-2-3. He's called Mahmoud Abbas and said, I still recognize you as president. He's done number two, which is to appoint Senator Mitchell and indicate that he wants to actually go down the path of conflict resolution rather than management. And number three is he's come out in condemnation, his administration has, in condemnation of Israel's settlements, and in particular the settlements in East Jerusalem, which is perhaps the most important, given that this country has shifted its policies when it comes to East Jerusalem. But that didn't last long. And very quickly, when faced with a little bit of opposition by Prime Minister Netanyahu, Obama begins to reverse course. And he begins to reverse course by, A, ignoring ongoing settlement activity, B, ignoring the ongoing demolitions that the Israelis are undertaking, and C, remaining silent on all of Israel's actions. So looking up to it up at that point in time, you can easily say, well, he's become just like every other U.S. president that we've had up until that time. Here's a president who takes a hands-off approach, facing a little bit of opposition, doesn't want to upset the cart, as the expression goes. He's somebody who's going to delay this to a further point in time until he has the ability to perhaps be in a second term. And as somebody who's lived through second term. So I feel like I've lived through this period process of new president, euphoria. Then there's a settling in that this new president can't do anything. Second term, euphoria, because the second term president can do something. Second term, elections happen, euphoria, because now the new president can do something. Late second term euphoria, because now it's, what did you guys call it, the lame duck?
Lame duck.
All right. And so I've lived through 16 years of euphoria, and the situation is obviously only getting worse. But what is it that Obama, so looking up into that first period, it's easy to look back and say, he's just like every other president, you have to wait for the next term, for the euphoria to kick in, and then you can begin to analyze President Obama's actions a little bit more critically, there's no need to be so harsh on him, etc. But yet, you have to now look at not only the second term, but also that first term. And there are some things that, it wasn't just a question of Obama just being like every other president and allowing things to continue along the same path, moving away from conflict resolution to conflict management as President Bush did. But here's where the detrimental things begin to kick in with President Obama. And the first is that the language when it comes to Israeli settlements has completely changed. Completely changed. From whether you look at Carter, even before Carter administration onward, you see a watering down of the U.S. position when it comes to Israel's settlements, from being illegal to later being an obstacle to peace, to later being, not helpful, then being a violation of roadmap obligations that was under President Bush, to now being, not even that, now it's continued settlement activity is not legitimate. Continued settlement activity is not legitimate. Paraphrasing, but that's the gist of it. What does continued settlement activity not legitimate means? It means that all of the other settlement activity that has taken place during that period of time is legitimate. It's simply the continued settlement activity that's not even illegal. It's just not legitimate. So in other words, moving away from this idea that there is law that governs the relationship between occupier and occupied, law that governs the relationship of whether you can steal land or not steal land, international law that's in place that affects each and every country, including this country, around the world. Instead, he's parsed it away so that what he's done is that his continued settlement activity is not legitimate. And so the question becomes, when does the continued begin? And if you look at the record of President Obama's period from 2008 until the current day, just before the current day, about 2015, not including 2016, you see that in this eight-year stretch, actually seven-year stretch, that the number of settlers has actually increased in the West Bank by well over 150,000. These are by Israeli statistics, not Palestinian statistics, which places it even higher. By official Israeli statistics, the number has increased by over 150,000. And so again, the question becomes, when does that continued part kick in? Does it kick in at 2008, when Obama assumes office? When he's elected, does it kick in at 2009? When he assumes office? Does it kick in at a later stage? When does that continued part kick in? The continued settlement activity is illegitimate. The second thing that Obama does that's detrimental, again, this isn't just a question of conflict management. We're just going to wait and kick the can to the next president. He begins to cement the siege on the Gaza Strip. The siege, to be clear, begins before him, predates him. It begins under President Bush. But what Obama does is he cements and allows to cement the continued siege on the Gaza Strip. And the idea that Israel is allowed to continue to blockade Gaza, even after the bombing campaigns, I'll get to that in just a second, President Obama, after the U.S. makes pledges that they're going to rebuild Gaza, he continues to allow the siege to remain in place on the Gaza Strip, a siege which the U.S. knows full well has made Gaza unlivable, a siege where the U.S. knows full well that 95% of the water supply is not fit for human consumption, a siege that they know very well is affecting disproportionately children under the age of 18. It's affected practically every aspect of life, whether it's education, health, your ability to travel, your ability to see your friends, your ability to have a normal life, has been impacted by this siege. And the next thing that President Obama does is he allows Israel to turn international law on its head. Not only when it comes to the settlement, but also when it comes to the bombing of Gaza. Now, under international law, there are certain places that you can't bomb, which is what I was talking about earlier with Goldstone, like mosques, schools, health facilities, etc. I mean, you don't need to have a lottery to realize that these things are things that shouldn't be bombed. And yet, what Obama does is he actually allows this to happen. He doesn't step back or push back on Israel when it undertakes two bombing campaigns during his presidency. There was one that predates him, as I was mentioning, but two bombing campaigns during his presidency. He doesn't push back on it, but instead continues to toe the line that an occupied people have to provide security to their occupier. And he continues to push forward and refuses to condemn Israel's bombing of hospitals, schools, etc., medical facilities, etc. In addition, the one-two of having the siege imposed on Gaza and the bombing campaign that Israel undertakes, these two bombing campaigns during his presidency, has now meant that there are about 100,000 structures that remain in some form of disrepair in Gaza, bombed or completely bombed or in need of very serious repair, without the ability to be able to repair any of those buildings. Now, even before these two bombing campaigns, the UN came out and said that by the year 2020, the Gaza Strip would become unlivable. And now with these two bombing campaigns, with over 100,000 buildings that still remain in a state of disrepair, the inability to to repair the water supply, an electricity supply that is at best providing 4 hours of electricity to the Gaza Strip, the inability to import gasoline, much-needed gasoline and fuel supplies into the Gaza Strip to be able to operate and to be able to live with electricity. These are all things that have been allowed and permitted under the Obama administration. Coupled with that, the Israelis in 2010, in May of 2010, undertake an attack on a flotilla in Gaza. And again, no word of condemnation from President Obama. All of this to say that all of these actions are actions that he simply allows to take place and sets the course for future events. Today in Israel, it's now considered, when Peres died, by the way, there were a lot of people who were talking about Peres' death and how detrimental men of peace, all this sort of stuff. One of the things that Peres did was Peres set into motion the idea that it's okay to bomb UN buildings. He did this in Qatar in 1996. What Obama does is he further cements the idea that it's okay for Israel to bomb UN buildings during the two attacks, 2012 and 2014. The next thing that Obama does is we are now in Palestine witnessing the highest rate of demolitions under any U.S. presidency. The highest rate of demolitions under any U.S. presidency. 2016 alone is almost triple the number of structures that were demolished in 2015. Just by the end of October of this year, 989 structures were demolished. Israelis demolished 989 structures, including 122 in East Jerusalem alone. Nearly triple the number of demolitions in 2015. The period of 2008 until 2016, these eight-year period of Obama, is the highest rate of home demolitions that we've ever witnessed in Palestine. In fact, higher than the two decades that preceded. Okay. And lastly, what Obama has done, and this perhaps is the most detrimental, is that he is the president, he's the only president since 1967, not to undertake any action, not to condemn any of Israel's actions in the Security Council. Mm-hmm. He's the first U.S. president not to condemn any of Israel's actions in the U.N. Security Council. So this isn't just a question of, you know, all of them, including Biden, including President Bush, both of them, condemned Israel's actions. He's the first U.S. president to do absolutely nothing. And so what does this sum total leave for us? The sum total leaves for us not a presidency, a president who has just decided he's just going to kick the can to the next president. Far be it. He's actually set into place a course of action that has legitimated Israel's ongoing theft of Palestinian land, displacement of Palestinians through the home demolitions, the legalization of the theft of Palestinian land through the settlement construction, the idea that it's okay to bomb places like Gaza, that it's okay to withhold electricity, that it's okay to have a faulty water supply. He's legitimated and allowed a continuing expulsion of Palestinians through the evictions from settlers. So all of this to say, this is not a president who's just simply kicked the can until the next one. And so where does this leave us now that we have President Trump? I can't believe I'm saying that, but anyway, President Trump. You know, this is where I get a lot of, I've been asked this a lot lately, of isn't this, you know, he's got to be better, he's going to be different, he's going to be, whatever. He's going to be worse. Why? First, he's already inheriting a system that is so bad that even if he does nothing, which I don't think Trump is going to do nothing, he's left a legacy that we will look back on this administration and say this was the turning point. The second thing that I think Trump is going to do is, you know, I live in Haifa, which is in Israel, and when you live there, it's commonplace to hear racist stuff, like just really racist stuff. And sometimes I call people out on it, sometimes you just, where am I living? And the racism in Israel has now reached new heights, to the point where all of the public opinion polls are saying that even younger generations don't want to live in the same building as Palestinians, that they don't want to see Arabs. They want to get them out of their country. The number of people who are voting for the right wing, and this isn't like a benign right wing, this is an extreme right wing, is on the rise. And you can say things like, oh, well, they're not voting in terms of Palestinian issues, but they're also not voting in terms of Palestinian issues. So just in the same way that you can say not all Trump supporters are racist, all Trump supporters took a decision at one point in time that they were going to excuse the racism. And same with the case, so is the case when it comes to the Israelis. With Trump in office now, that racism that exists in Israel that may have had a little bit of a break on it because of President Obama and the U.S. administration is now going to go full tilt, full speed ahead. There is no holding back that level of racism. Already there are attempts to legalize the settlements. There are some bills that the Knesset is trying to pass to legalize the theft of private Palestinian land for settlements. I think that Trump's going to look the other way, not pay attention to that. And then other talk is that he will obviously move the embassy. Moving the embassy isn't as huge of importance. Other than the idea that it creates this notion that that Israel gets to be rewarded for its settlement activity, and so all of this is to say, and that's the mild version of Trump. That's the mild version. This is the version of Trump that if he decides he's not really going to do a whole lot, that's the mild version of Trump. So to close up, and I'm going to close quickly now, is to say that I know it's very easy to look at Trump and to say we're in for a really rough 4, potentially 8 years. But I think that we also shouldn't gloss over the 8 very brutal years that Palestinians have lived under an Obama presidency, a presidency in which we were told and promised that he was going to put this on the forefront of his agenda. A presidency in which he made clear that he didn't want to see continuing settlement activity. A presidency in which he made clear that he wanted to see this resolved. So I think, just to end up, is we need to really, if there are a few months left in the Obama term, there is some talk of the U.S. putting into place not vetoing a resolution on settlements. There is some talk of the U.S. not vetoing a resolution on parameters, etc. I think that at this point in time, the damage has been done.
Thank you, Deanna, so much. That was wonderful. So why don't we just very informally... are there questions or comments anyone would like to make? Yes.
Try to tell us why, what caused the shift in Obama's approach? Why has he taken this stand that he did, which is, which you described very, very fully? in the talk.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to say, because I think there are a number of different events that may have led to the shift. I think the first shift was that at a certain point he decided that the political calculation, and I forgot to mention, by the way, the $38 billion package is going to Israel. Mm-hmm. No thank you to you, but anyway. no thank you, America. So I think that part of it was that he made a political calculation that this was something that simply wasn't worth it any longer, that he was facing significant pushback. I think the other thing is that he miscalculated where Israeli public opinion actually was. Mm-hmm. And he was willing to push if he had seen that there was an Israeli public that was also willing to push back, to go alongside with him. And he didn't see that. In fact, he didn't get that message at all. By the time he made his Cairo speech in 2009, it was already clear that Israel had already shifted to the right. Like, Netanyahu's victory wasn't a little blip on the calendar. It was a reflection of political opinion in the country. And so I think that for him, the idea that he's going to have to risk something, place some political capital in that, and again, this is his first term, and there isn't an Israeli public that's backing him, was something that made him take a backseat. But then that doesn't really explain the second term stuff. Mm-hmm. And by the second term, I think at that point, he just decided that he was over with it. Now, I've heard other analyses as well. I've heard people who were in the know, who were in the White House and otherwise, who said that part of the problem was that this Hamas-Fatah split, he didn't really want to go down the path of supporting Mahmoud Abbas, because Mahmoud Abbas wouldn't be able to deliver. I've heard that many times. I've heard other people say that if Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas weren't ready to reconcile, he wasn't going to go down that path. That strikes me as a little bit false, because you don't need Mahmoud Abbas to stop an attack on Gaza. Right? You don't need Mahmoud Abbas to stop an attack on the flotilla. You don't need Mahmoud Abbas to be facilitating the fuel into Gaza, or the repair of the electricity supply or the water supply. I mean, he doesn't, or to condemn settlements. He doesn't need any of that. So the second term answer is, I actually don't know. I think he just decided that was not a political calculation he was going to make.
To follow on from that, you haven't mentioned the Iran deal and what
right.
effect that had on his policy.
I don't think it did, to be quite honest. I think that Iran was Iran. And that there's a lot of speculation that Iran would then free up Obama to then address Israel, or that because there was the Iran deal that he was going to take a hands-off approach to Israel. I actually don't think that any of that really had anything to do with it. In fact, if anything, the Iran deal should have pushed Obama further to be challenging Israel, because, as you remember, it was Israel that was tried to block this Iran deal, and thankfully they were not successful in that. But it's hard to say. It really is hard. I mean, I'm not in his mind. And so what I'm told now is that there is some talk of having a Security Council resolution, that nobody's in his mind except for him. He hasn't really revealed anything. Who knows? But I can tell you, up until now, this is his legacy. And even if there's a resolution that comes out at this late hour condemning settlements or parameters resolution or anything like that, the damage has been done. The damage has been done for generations.
So are we moving from a Labour-like government in this country to a Likud-like administration?
Moving? So you don't think it's been Likud already? on this particular issue, you think like it's moving... The only thing that I think that the big shift and like the most detrimental turning point in Palestinian history, modern Palestinian history, was the negotiations process. Clinton. I think that when he took the path of going down this bilateral negotiations process, it set into motion a whole spectrum that is very difficult to undo, whether it's the establishment of the Palestinian Authority, and through that the security regime, where 40% of the budget goes towards security rather than to anything else, double the amount that goes to education and health combined. Whether it's the idea that there has to be bilateral negotiation, I think all of that began under Clinton. And the ability to turn back from that could have been done under the Bush administration, but he was an ideologue and chose not to. The problem with Obama is that Obama had the ability to do much more and chose not to. So is this the Likud version of America? I think the Likud version of America came into place with Clinton. And I think that has only just been a question of shades ever since.
So I guess I'm interested in the legal perspective and how in Israel's disregard for international law, and if there's anything that can be done to sort of enforce it in a different way that's not reliant on sort of U.S. power taking the lead on that, if there are any other things.
Yeah. So, you know, the biggest problem with international law is that it's international law, is that there's no way of enforcing it. International law is, it consists of state practice and state enforcement. And insofar as you have state practice can actually change international law and develop international law. And that's why I'm so worried about, as I was talking about the idea that it's only focusing on continued settlement activity. Mm-hmm. My fear is that, so under international law, all of the settlements are illegal. There is no scope for legality of the settlements. The world has recognized the annexation of East Jerusalem as illegal. All the settlements are illegal. The problem is that we're going down this path where you have a country that's trying to change international law, which is Israel, and another country that's bolstering that change, being the United States. And so my fear as an international lawyer is that the more that state practice changes, the more that what we define international law to be also changes. Mm-hmm. So just in the same way that if you look at domestic criminal law, why is it that white, quote-unquote, white-collar crimes are considered, get less penalty than other crimes? Is because there's a significant amount of pressure that is exerted on the criminal system to make sure that white-collar crimes don't get punished receive lighter sentences. So too in the international system, you can't ignore the element of power that's in play. And that's why I was saying I'm so afraid of shifting international law. Now, can it be enforced? Yes, but it requires a number of different things. First, it requires the Palestinians to go to the ICC, the International Criminal Court. And the ICC is itself a very politicized body. Although the Palestinians have signed on to the International Criminal Court, they haven't yet brought a case before the International Criminal Court. And even if they were, it's not to say that the prosecutor would really take it and run with it. It's become so politicized that even where they've opened up investigations, there have been some investigations that have gone on for now 9 years in Afghanistan. How long did it take to investigate? So it could go down that path, but it might be blocked by the prosecutor. That's assuming that the Palestinians can take it down that path. Other mechanisms is you can take it to the International Court of Justice. You can try, which was done in the past with the wall. And successful, but no action on it. You can try to get international law enforced domestically, whether it's in the United States or in other countries, Canada, Europe, etc. All those mechanisms are available, but they are long-term mechanisms, not short-term mechanisms, which is why the diplomatic front is so important. That being said, I think it's important that we as Palestinians begin to pursue those legal options. Because if we don't, then we are going to see the watering down of language when it comes to settlements. We've already seen it. Even with this U.S. position now, although the Europeans have still held firm to their position on settlements, that doesn't mean they're going to hold firm in 5 years' time. And already in place with the way that they've begun to recognize the settlements in East Jerusalem, it's already happening. So there are mechanisms, and we should be taking advantage of those mechanisms. Sadly, we don't have a leadership list.
Point of clarification, did you say the Europeans' position on East Jerusalem settlements is gradually, you're seeing it shift?
They keep saying that it hasn't shifted, but I can tell you, one of the things that they love to see is they love to see Palestinians going to Israeli courts to try to seek redress for their rights in Israeli courts. And this is a court system that has proven to be not just a failure, it's designed to be a failure for Palestinians. And so the Europeans want to see Palestinians continuing to legitimate a system that shouldn't have any legitimacy whatsoever.
You have been listening to a presentation by Canadian-Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu, who now lives in Haifa. This is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Today we're expected to believe there's not enough money for this, not enough money for that. Whilst nearly £700 million is found with the blink of an eye to refurbish the offices of Queen Elizabeth, the richest woman in the world. So are we being sold a putt day after day, night after night? Is this just glorified smash and grab by the rich and powerful, a kind of criminal elite? Tonight we take a good look at the money system and how some people get a licence to make money up out of nowhere, while others starve. What really happened in 2008, how the threat of cutting off our money is used to control us, and how to fix this rotten system. Class postponed from last week, a couple of items, the religion of war. We look back to the last Republican president, George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech, how hollow his words seem now, plus the brave new technocratic world. Little chips that pay money for you. Now, where have we heard that before? Tonight, we listen to author Aldous Huxley. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Apologies for being a little bit out of breath. My car wouldn't start, so I had to walk all the way here, and a little, well, partly run as well. Tonight, lows of 5 degrees Celsius and mainly dry. This weekend, highs of 8 Celsius, mainly cloudy weekend. Next week, again, around 8 degrees with sunny spells. Next weekend, the 3rd and 4th of December, highs of 8 again. Sunny spells too, hopefully not any rain, though, over the next week or so. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon.
Getting dark, isn't it, now, in the evenings? But first thing I've got to ask you about, Tim, is about this Metro bus, because I know you were very much involved in the city's transport policy, making some big decisions about how our money's spent in past years. What do you make of it all? Because I think there's quite a lot of people there wondering, what is all this pain for if it doesn't look like we're going to get much gain at the end of it?
Well, I mean, what we're seeing is a cost of delays. Much of this delays was, I'm afraid, when the mayor came into office. He put the scheme on hold because he wanted to review it. Those changes have created quite a bit of extra cost. A lot of that has, of course, come from delay. If you plan to borrow money 1 year but you do it another, that comes at a cost of millions of extra. I mean, the reality is Metrobus was never going to transform the city's public infrastructure. I mean, the transport infrastructure in the city is dire. I don't think there's any other way to describe it. There's been a lack of funding over many decades. This was just the first step in what was supposed to be many steps. Following this, of course, was going to be a major investment in rail. We've seen that being delayed. We've also seen massive reductions, including the announcement now that we're not even going to get electrification in the city. So I do think, I mean, to be clear, Metrobus was just one of several steps. And it does, that first small step has been delayed, and now we're seeing what should have been the next steps also be delayed or cut. I think people are rightly fed up. they have every right to say to the council, what on earth are you doing about this? And what I hope now as a council, and certainly with the mayor, we can actually move forward and say to government, enough is enough. This city produces a lot of economic benefit for the country. We now need the public infrastructure to keep it going.
Well, is there any evidence that Marvin's doing that?
Well, to be fair, he's only been in office for sort of six months or so. But I think now he's had the chance to get his feet on the ground. Now is the time to push. We've got, I think, unfortunately, but we've got this new role of Metro Mayor coming in that's going to take over transport infrastructure. What we need is less talk and more action, and we definitely need more government finances. They've announced this new infrastructure fund. Let's see some of it come to Bristol.
Well, what do you make of this new Metro Mayor? Because this is, seems to me like just more power disappearing out of people's hands to higher and higher levels. A little bit like a kind of, you know, when we join the EU, the power goes to Brussels. More and more decisions are made further and further away. And surely that's a similar thing going on with this Metro Mayor. On top of that, you've got the fact that because you've got the three big local authorities that are going to be part of that area, it won't necessarily reflect the wishes of the people of Bristol.
Well, it might not. There's always a danger when you work together. I've always felt strongly the three, well, it should be the four, but it is now going to only be the three local authorities for the Bristol area working together is a good thing, especially around transport and economy and planning. The problem what we're seeing now is just a couple of people will hold all of that power, and one in particular, which will be this Metro Mayor. And when you put the power into the hands of just one person, you naturally create distance, and that's when you get unpopular decision-making. And I think also there's going to be a great deal of confusion. I think the public feel that this role is being imposed on them. There's very little public engagement in the whole process. We do fear that turnout is going to be diabolical in May. And so there is a real question here of power really going to an institution that nobody understands and nobody really wants. There is some power coming down from government, but as usual, that all gets highly watered down, and in too much power is going up and not enough coming down.
Martin, you were arguing a couple of weeks ago when we had the Tusk chap on here, that is saying, well, actually, maybe it would be better for political parties to focus all their attention on national elections because the local authorities have very little power nowadays.
Well, I think there is an element of that because we're going through, you know, there's a kind of smoke and mirrors effect where we're talking about devolving power to metro mayors, but at the same time, the power of local authorities are gradually being undermined through things, you know, through national policies that are made at national level.
You're saying devolving, but you could also say giving away your power, couldn't you?
Well, yes, I mean, just think about having a mayor in Bristol, which I oppose, as many people did. We had a big row about whether we were going to have a mayor. Then, about 15% of the electorate decided they did want a mayor, so we ended up having one. But in actual fact, the mayor, whoever it is, whether it's George Ferguson, Marvin Rees or anybody else, has got to make millions of pounds worth of cuts, which is what the central government has already determined. And, of course, the local authorities then end up getting the blame for what's going on, whoever runs them, but in actual fact, the decisions were all made in Westminster in the first place. So it's all, it's all basically a trick.
Well, I sympathise and generally agree with that. I do think there's a real challenge for local government. People vote for councillors hoping they're going to make a difference. With a mayoral system, our powers are limited. But increasingly, I think Marvin, as mayor, has discovered his powers are limited because in the end, you're limited by the budget you've got. There's one reason why some people have gone for the Metro Mayor option, because they see a small budget attached to it. My worry is that budget is very small, the ask on the role will be far higher, and that people will be left very disappointed.
But hang on, this is a city deal, isn't it, which the Lib Dems were pushing for?
No, the original city deal, which we got, was before all of this mayoral stuff. That we're all fine for. And the combined authority we support. Where the issue we have is over this idea of the power being put into the hands of one individual. The voting structure for the new combined authority is unbelievably complex. So complex, I've not yet encountered anybody, including the officers who've written it, who actually understand it.
Is that deliberate?
Well, I think what it is it's one of these things where everyone has tried to make everybody else happy. So you have votes where only the mayor votes, you have votes where the mayor and the leaders vote, you have votes where the leaders vote, and you have votes where certain leaders can veto the views of other leaders. That is the voting system that has been developed for the combined authority.
Well, we're going to have some fun with that. And yet, as you've said, the Metro Mayor actually makes all the final decisions. So what's the point in the voting situation anyway?
Well, yesterday I discovered that turns out not to be the case. Actually, on a lot of powers, they're jointly held, which actually means the Metro Mayor can make the decision, but only if the local authority involved agrees.
So whose big idea was this Metro Mayor?
Well, it seems to have come out of Tory central office. Greg Clark was a big supporter of them, and George Osborne. We did get very close to it being scrapped, actually, when Theresa May took power. For a few weeks, it looked as if they were going to scrap them, but somebody with the voice in her ear managed to convince her to carry on with them, unfortunately.
Amazing. Also, with the whole business of the Metro bus again, I mean, surely, Tim, I'm going to come back to this because you were doing transport on the City Council in the run-up to this, so, I mean, surely you've got to bear some of the responsibility for all those delays. And now, looking at the whole situation with this, it looks like there's only going to be three of these things an hour.
Well, I won the funding for it, so I was in power. I was in power running transport when we won the funding. I mean, we were very clear. I upped the frequency on the one which was only going to be once every 20 minutes, saying that that is not a frequency high enough. We shifted it up. Unfortunately, since that decision, that's been reviewed by following transport execs, and they've pushed it down. I agree. I mean, if you're waiting for a bus for 20 minutes, that is not a frequent metro service.
You say following transport execs. The name Mark Bradshaw is ringing in my ears.
Well, you would have to ask Mark why that's been reduced down. It's in particular, it's the link from Hengrove to out to Long Ashton. It's that route in particular, which has got a frequency of actually, I think it's possibly less than once every 20 minutes.
Well, Sir Mark has agreed to grace us with his presence in January, so we'll have to ask him all about the what really happened there. At least we know, thanks to you, Tim, what the right questions are to ask. Anyway, thanks for that. So, look, let's have a look, listen now to, because there's been some big developments. Well, I say big. I mean, certainly some plates seem to be shifting in the historic abuse inquiry this week, child sexual abuse, which it certainly looks like has been going on for decades and been consistently covered up by various public officials, including the police. When we spoke, must be 2 years ago now, to Nick Outerside, former newspaper editor, who was himself abused when he was in the Scouts as a youngster. After the Jimmy Savile affair, he then went to his local police force and gave him a statement about what had happened to him. They then told him, oh, well, this guy that was abusing you, yes, we've had reports from other kids that were abused by him, but he's now dead. Well, 2 years later, Nick Outerside found that the police were lying to him. Actually, the guy wasn't dead at all, and he was still alive, and he was about to die, and he did die. But, this kind of thing does not put great faith in people, doesn't give people great faith in the police when it looks as if the police have been involved in this cover-up. Anyway, this week we've had calls by various MPs, including Chuka Ramuna and the Rotherham MP, who's the MP for the constituency where the abuse happened up in Rotherham, and where Alexis Jay was doing her inquiry a couple of years ago, which found something like 1,700 children there had been, over a period of about 14 years, had been abused. And she as well has called for a complete rethink, saying that the inquiry isn't working under Alexis Jay, this new chair, who's a former social worker. But anyway, let's have a listen to what the QC Michael Mansfield has been saying this week on the historic abuse inquiry problems. He even suggests that they may be deliberate.
What has gone seriously wrong here is a dismal failure to consult with the survivors' groups from the beginning about appointments and about the substantive materials that had to be assembled. Secondly, the actual appointments of the chair have been inappropriate, one after another. Just how many mistakes can you make? And of course, some of the groups are saying, have these mistakes been made on purpose?
Well, that's obviously a question that's rising in people's minds, especially for the more prominent paedophiles which are being investigated. One of the things about the Jimmy Savile affair is that lots of people who were historically abused by scoutmasters, whatever, have come forward, and that's created a lot of problems for the police because it is a historic, abuse is widespread. But of course, the real problem is that the high level abuse by people in positions of authority and Kinkora Boys Home, which I've mentioned frequently on this programme, it looks as if MI5 were using the Kinkora Boys Home as a means of blackmail of various political figures in Northern Ireland.
Well, we've also had Sir Peter Hayman, the deputy head of MI6. He was someone who shown to have been abusing kids, and then obviously he's dead now. But if you've got the deputy head of the Secret Services, Tim, doing abuse, then it makes very difficult for there to be any proper investigation. In fact, sometimes more likely there may be a cover-up. Anyway, what's your thoughts about what's been happening over the last couple of weeks with this? Because we've also seen the Shirley Oaks Survivors Group. We're hoping to have them on in the next couple of weeks, actually, because they've said, well, we're fed up with this inquiry. It's been going for 2.5 years now. Middle of December, we're going to release the names of 60 alleged paedophiles because we've already done our inquiries and we've got their names.
I think the inquiry really, it's got nowhere, and it's not likely to get anywhere anytime soon. And you can understand the frustration of the families, and in particular those people who've suffered abuse. I guess the positive I would say that's come out of this is that the more we talk about this, the more it is going to be revealed. And let us remember, we focus on the abuse by the high profile public figures and the abuse of those children in care, which of course is particularly horrendous. But the vast majority of abuse goes on behind closed doors in normal family homes. And the reality is, as people listen to this, odds are you know somebody who's been abused. You may not realise you know somebody who's been abused. And the only thing I would say of good that could come out of this is now that more people are coming forward to report abuse, and hopefully it will make it more difficult for abusers to get away with what they've got away with, and hopefully reduce down the amount of abuse.
I suppose the take home from a lot of this is that if you do have this sexual abuse going on at very high levels, maybe within the Secret Services, for example, it makes it possible for the lower level abuse to happen. Whereas, it just shows that, I suppose, the veil of national security has been thrown over this and used as an excuse to cover it up in the past. And also, I suppose, possibly threats to police who've tried to investigate it, or just having investigations pulled from them. Someone comes along, taps them on the shoulder and says, right, you're off this inquiry now, you're doing something completely different. Or maybe even you're sacked.
Well, I think I agree. We have seen that the establishment have closed ranks and protected themselves, even used abuse over many, many years. But let us not forget, also, I think within society itself, people have suppressed, have tried to stop people from coming forward, have said that best not talk about it, let's move on. What we're now seeing now is a culture where people are going to feel more confident to come forward and report this, and hopefully that will reduce down the amount of future abuse.
Very interesting. Very brave, I think, actually, of the Shirley Oaks people to say, well, we're going to release these names. We're fed up with this. It's going 2.5 years now. I think that's what they want, is they just want, at the very least, the names to be known. Then there can possibly be prosecutions. But all the time, the names are kept secret of the people that they've collected evidence on as sexual abusers in a systematic way. I mean, effectively, Martin, what happened was paedophiles totally infiltrated the social services in Lambeth Council, and they were running children's homes.
Yeah, well, what I suspect is that children's homes have been a target, like Kinkora was in Northern Ireland, for the use of paedophilia for blackmail purposes. And that's not to say that that's the totality of abuse. As Tim quite rightly points out, it's much more widespread than many people realise. And as he says, it goes on mainly inside family homes. Stepfathers are frequently abusers. Not always, but frequently.
Well, another bit of news this week. Well, actually, it's really last week. It's the passing, finally, by the Lords, by the Snoopers Charter. And I suppose we should all be on our knees, really, saying we wish the Lib Dems were back in government again, because Lib Dems did actually block it in the coalition government from going through, but it's now gone through, Tim.
Yes, and so everyone should be aware the government now has far more rights to seize any of your activities. And in fact, they have far more rights than any other government in any other democracy. So, and it has been unbelievable how that has gone through with virtually not even a whisper against it. I think there are some questions over what were some previous very strong activists who opposed this, who have not stood up and said, wait, hold it. And this is the problem we see, is that government use the fear as a factor to get these things through. And what we mustn't allow is that government takes too much power to itself, or actually puts us in such a state of fear we actually give them too much power. And the lack of checking over this and the lack of resistance has been shameful.
Well, about a year ago, I was just having a look at what Michael Mansfield was saying about the abuse inquiry. I stumbled across this interesting clip on YouTube, and I've got a little edit of it here. And here is Michael Mansfield, QC, this human rights lawyer, talking last year about his fears over this snooper's charter. And it was once the Conservative government, David Cameron, had been elected in. Some say not elected, because there's 29 constituencies where there's big questions about expenses and possible fraud in the last general election, but they've now voted this through. But this is what Michael Mansfield had to say about the snooper's charter around about this time last year.
Well, I think we've reached a historic and extremely dramatic watershed in all our lives. I was brought up in the shadow of 1984, George Orwell. Then everybody said, oh, we'll never have anything like that. Well, we can't have anything like that. You know, our whole lives manipulated, determined, and all the rest of it. That is exactly where we are now. In 2015, we have an Orwellian society in which all our data, our very existence, is monitored through screens and information about every aspect of our lives. And the latest proposals from the government actually put into concrete form what George Orwell was talking about. In other words, every website you visit is going to be stored by the providers so that somebody else can have a look and say, oh, because they apparently are looking for, what are they looking for? You know, child abusers, terrorists and so on. But they're going to... Why don't they shut down the world while they look for criminals? It is outrageous. Legalising the interception on a bulk scale, storage on a bulk scale, and collection of really social information in terms of the websites. I also happen to know, because it happens all the time, that irrespective of government, and this has been going on anyway with the government since 2000, only they haven't admitted it, is that ordinary commercial companies and operators, 14-year-olds, can hack into, you know, TalkTalk. My bank account could probably drip away tomorrow. So what I'm worried about is the technology is there to take over your life, and it is doing so already at any level. You can even go and use your Tor router and become anonymous. They can still track you. That's my concern, is that we do not have enough control. We've almost been sleepwalking into a situation and we automatically... What's the first thing you do when you wake up? Mobile phone, iPad, whatever. What's the first thing you do? You go to a meeting, even the one I've been at. People are on their iPhone and their phone straight away. We've lost the ability to realise that we should not allow these monitors to be inside the hearts of our lives. And I'm hoping people will wake up to the society in which they're now living. And they have to decide, do they want more of the same, or do they want to bring about some ring fencing to these powers so that the humanity that we've all got is allowed to breathe again?
Well, Martin, the Labour MPs in this city actually voted for this, didn't they? It was on national security grounds.
Did they?
Yes, they did.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm just looking. I'll put a link up if you want on the show page at thisweek.org.uk
national security grounds is absolutely absurd. The police have always had the powers to investigate people.
Shall I say, just say, the only big block vote against it was the SNP.
Well, good for the SNP is all I can say. And presumably the Liberal Democrats also voted against, am I correct?
We've opposed this all along.
I mean, this national security argument is absolutely specious. The police have always had the powers, if they suspect somebody is engaged in terrorist or other activities, to investigate them and to look at what they've been doing. General fishing expeditions in general to look at everybody are wrong in principle. They're actually written in the US Constitution, written in the 1770s. They said the interception of private communications by the state is expressly forbidden. Not when we might do it sometimes. And as Benjamin Franklin said, those who are prepared to give up liberty in pursuit of security deserve neither liberty nor security. And of course, the real suspicion is that the people, the intelligence services doing the snooping, are actually involved in the terrorism. But that's another big question.
Interestingly enough, yes, all the Bristol Labour MPs voted for it, except for Thangam Debonair, who abstained. But anyway, it's a bit of a worrying world we're moving into, where we think that it's almost like the kind of presumption of guilt rather than innocence, if you're going to just keep all of your internet records. And it means also it's quite easy for the security services, who we don't necessarily trust all that much, to get can just go through and do phishing operations on our lives.
They're not under democratic control, as the police, in theory, at least, are.
We've had the autumn statement this week. UK government reveals its infrastructure budget. That is a £23 billion fund has been announced by the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer to provide additional spending in areas he said were key to boosting productivity, transport, housing, digital communications and research and development. Chancellor Philip Hammond announced the fund in his autumn statement this week. It includes £2.3 billion for a new housing infrastructure fund. He said the fund would be used for projects such as roads and water connections that would support the construction of up to 100,000 new homes in the areas where they were needed most. Maybe he's helping out Bristol Water there, the private water companies, with public money. Further, £1.4 billion will be used to provide 40,000 new affordable homes. Tim, sounds like good news.
Well, a lot of this does sound like good news. I've always been a strong believer that during difficult times, what you do is you invest in your infrastructure, and that will help build you out of difficult times. The money for affordable homes is particularly welcome. I think there is sometimes a slight difference in interpretation of what is an affordable home between what a Conservative government minister considers an affordable home and what a normal person might consider an affordable home. The key thing I would like to sort of push here is the real need for us to put money into public infrastructure in some of our cities. If we want our cities to continue to thrive and we want to continue to get the tax returns to keep the country going, we need to deal with congestion, and only through some very serious money can we do that. And 50 million here or 50 million there might sound a lot, but in public transport terms is very small fry. And if we want to really tackle congestion in this city, we need billions to be coming here.
I wonder, we're talking last a couple of weeks ago again, Martin, weren't we, about the idea of free public transport, how much it would cost to make the buses free in Bristol, because that would take a hell of a lot of weight off the roads, wouldn't it? A lot of people would just hop on the bus instead.
Well, it would cost you about £30 million a year.
Well, that's less than 50 million, so maybe that's doable. I mean, Martin was just suggesting that the other day and explaining how in Ken Livingstone's London in the 1980s, he had a whole plan to slowly move towards free public transport. Of course, the other great benefit of that is you get much less injuries on the road, whether it's cyclists or pedestrians.
I mean, it's something to be said for it. I mean, the issue is sometimes when you make something completely free, it sometimes loses its value. But I think trying to make sure public transport is affordable...
So do you think people would just get on the bus and go round and round just for the sake of it?
Well, actually, some people do. that's not necessarily a bad thing if there was no one else in that seat.
Well, if the point about if you make things free, there's a cost involved in people paying, you know, ticket machines, ticket collectors, etc. So one of the things about making things free is you can write all that off. And, of course, it's thinking big and thinking outside the box. Now, we don't do an awful lot of that, but, I mean, in Seattle, I understand, in the United States of America, public transport is free. That's the home of the Silicon Valley and all the rest of it. That's the future.
The other thing is, of course, in the cold winter months, if you're homeless, actually getting on a bus and going round and round might actually keep you warm and keep you safe, other than being out freezing on the streets. Another similar story here, the billions of wasted NHS cash no one wants to mention. This is on the Our NHS website. Come on, one of the national newspapers, pick up on this wonderful journalist called Caroline Malloy. She says, as calls mount for the NHS cash crisis to be solved by charging patients, there's one pot of money that sits glistening and untouched. Calls to solve the NHS cash crisis by charging patients have mounted, with the NHS Confederation calling for £75 a night hotel fees for hospital stays, or much longer waiting lists. But there is one pot of money that sits curiously unexamined, glistening and untouched. It's the cost of the NHS market itself. Administering the hugely expensive artificial marketplace created by successive governments to allow NHS and private providers to compete with each other to offer services to purchasers and the NHS. No one knows the exact cost of this bureaucratic marketplace, but a recent estimate by Rebel Lib Dems put the figure as high as £30 billion a year. So, I mean, we could solve the NHS it looks like deficit overnight just by getting rid of this marketplace. And well done, Tim. Well done, Lib Dems, for doing this little calculation, which no one else thought to do.
I'm not sure how you become a rebel, Lib Dem. I didn't think we actually had enough left to have a rebel. But this article
is from 2014. I mean, it's not absolutely bang up to date.
Yes, but that's how you have a rebel Lib Dem then. I think there's a very good question for the marketplace. I think I understand where those from the right were trying to do with big bureaucracies, you can get waste. The problem is when you try to bring in a marketplace, you create a whole new level of waste. Actually, this goes back to the same discussion about making bus travel free.
Yeah.
And that is where you actually try to put in costings to stuff that's free, you actually sometimes generate additional waste. And I think that's what this is pointing to, is that everyone's billing each other. And having recently tried to navigate the NHS to get an appointment with a consultant, it took several different meetings and several different appointments to get the one we needed, because no one wanted to pay the bill because it all went to certain cost centres, and it was such a bureaucratic nightmare. So I've actually experienced this myself recently. I have no doubt it's costing billions of pounds. Quite rightly, the NHS has got a challenge in front of itself. It needs to reduce costs so it can reinvest that money into frontline services. This could be the first place to look at.
I mean, one of the maddest things in the world, Martin, is this whole idea of doctors being put in charge of these clinical commissioning groups, having to be basically hawking around the marketplaces, trying to get the cheapest deal here and there.
Well, that's what doctors used to do before the NHS existed. They were essentially businessmen who sold medical care. And of course, the concept of the NHS, and it was at the time of the 1940s when people believed in planning and the superiority of planning over markets. And what we've seen is the Tory government brought in the purchaser-provider split. We had 13 years of Labour government where they didn't undo the reform. Then we had a coalition government where we carried on with the same. And I would argue that the fundamental principle of the NHS, which is what makes it the most efficient in the world, despite this internal market, is that it is, in fact, a top-down planned exercise. And in actual fact, if we went back to the original conception, provision for free. For example, you've seen various hospitals complaining about the foreigners have got to show their passports before they get treated and so on, saying we've got enough to do without looking at people's passports. That's actually an extra burden on us. It's not saving us any money. And if things are just free, and don't forget that some diseases, and this is the whole point about diseases, they're communicable. If you don't get the person with HIV at an early stage, they pass it on to somebody else. So it's actually much cheaper. And things like needles, for example, you want redundancy in this. In other words, you always use clean needles, even if it looks like a waste on the balance sheet, because that means nobody gets infected with HIV, and that saves you a lot of money in the long run.
I can remember a similar thing at the BBC, actually, in the early 1990s. They brought in this thing called producer choice, where you used to be able to just phone up and get bits and pieces of information from all over the corporation, and all of a sudden, good old John Burt, bless him, brought in this system where you've got to fill out a little form, and you've got to get the permission of your producer and your senior editor if you want to make a phone call. That seems to me to be what this excellent article is all about, and I'll put a link to that up on our show page if people want to go and actually have a look and see how bonkers this market in the NHS is and how much it's costing us. Anyway, the UK has been seen to be borrowing £122 billion more than expected, says the Office for Budget Responsibility this week. Britain's government will end up borrowing £122 billion more over the next 5 years than it expected before the country voted for Brexit, Chancellor Philip Hammond said on Wednesday. Britain's expected to run a budget deficit of nearly £22 billion in 2019-20 financial year. I suppose George Osborne is sort of hiding under a rock somewhere. He doesn't really want to talk anymore because it doesn't look like he's getting anywhere near meeting his fiscal targets, Martin.
No, and I think this is what's happened is that the government have basically given up attempting to reduce the deficit on the timescale they originally suggested 8 years ago or even 5 years ago. And nobody's even picked up. That means, in actual fact, that a lot of the pain that people have been put through was unnecessary and pointless. But of course, they're not. I mean, there is one more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner that repenteth than the people that, you know, in a way, the fact that they've accepted that they can't get it down on that time scale is a positive thing. And what's particularly...
Well, hasn't the actual reality come to bite them in the bum, really?
Well, that's exactly. Reality was always going to come back to this, that you can't actually get it down in that kind of time scale. But what I find particularly risible is all of these Tories attacking the Office of Budget Responsibility, which they set up to be an independent voice telling them what the actual figures were instead of the Chancellor and the Bank of England cooking it up in private, and then when it tells them what they don't want to hear, they want it abolished. And in any case, it's not even clear that it could be a lot worse than that. If Deutsche Bank collapses and there's a big crash like 2008, it's going to be a lot more than 122 billion. That's just presuming that everything just carries on as it is now, which of course is a big presumption.
Tim, also we've got Tory MPs just voted down a bid to reveal the impact of their £3.4 billion welfare cuts. Even Ian Duncan Smith has called on the government to reverse the planned welfare cuts. This is in the Mirror. Tory MPs voted down this week a motion calling for them to come clean on how hard their public spending cuts have hit on Britain's poorest. The government used to prepare a distributional analysis of spending cuts ahead of the budget, an autumn statement which breaks down how hard people are hit by their income by income bracket, but they stopped publishing this last year. Labour tabled a motion calling on the government to scrap the cuts and start publishing the distribution figures again, but it was defeated by 24 votes. Labour's John McDonnell said further cuts to benefits would be a harmful disaster for low earners and the vulnerable if the government fails to do a U-turn in next week's autumn statement. Well, of course, they didn't. The Shadow Chancellor said the planned cuts to employment support allowance build and universal credit would hit the quality of life for millions of people, Tim.
Well, the government are doing all they can to hide the fact that universal credit is going to really hit some of our poorest families. And it particularly will hit, which is a slight irony about it, those families which are trying to get into work are on the breadline, and they're the ones that are going to suffer the most. Also, those with disabilities, so if they get ESA, will find them, they're getting hit as well. I think they need to take a hard look at this. I understand things have got tougher with the Brexit decision. That doesn't mean you pass on the punishment to those with the least in society.
But
I do hope they have a rethink about some of these cuts, which are being hidden around the universal welfare rollout.
Well, that just seems very unlikely that they're going to have a rethink, because all of the motion seems to be towards taking, really cutting the welfare bill right back, what used to be called Social Security. Do you remember that? You pay in, and then when you need it, you get the money back. Well, apparently they don't really want to give you the money back. You get sanctioned, you just don't have any money, you can't pay your rent, etc., etc. And it seems to me that we're moving towards a world where there are no benefits, Tim. That's the way we're heading.
No, I agree. And one of the issues around benefits, which I think people need to understand, is what people have seen is a large rise in their rent, especially from the private rental sector. That's not their fault, and they're not getting the money. In fact, often it is private landlords who make donations to the Conservative Party who are getting the money. And I think we need to completely relook at our housing structure. And before we cut people's benefits, we need to be able to provide them with affordable housing, not say to them, no, you've now got to pay this extra £100 in rent each month, which you can't afford. Giving people that choice is no choice at all. So I think one of the challenges is to deal with the costs of housing and not actually try to attack the poorest that are forced to live in this expensive housing.
Well, before we hear from Martin, let's go to the House of Commons on Wednesday from Prime Minister's questions where the subject of disabled benefit cuts came up. I think it was Angus Robertson brought it up.
Angus Robertson!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We in these benches have repeatedly brought up the devastating impact on disabled people from the UK benefits system. The government plans to cut support for people with long-term health difficulties by £30 a week. Last week, my SNP colleague, the member for Airdrie and Shotts, proposed a motion which was passed by this House with support from both Labour and Conservative members for these cuts to be postponed. Yeah. Will the Prime Minister act on the vote of this House?
Yeah. Let me say to the Right Honourable Gentleman what we've been doing in relation to benefits for disabled people. The overall funding for disability benefits will be higher in every year up to 2020 than it was in 2010. We have been focusing support on those who most need it, those who are not able to get into the workplace. For those who are able at some stage to get into the workplace, we've been providing a wider package of support, and I'm pleased to say that over the last 3 years, nearly 600,000 more disabled people are now in the workplace with the dignity of having a job, which is what many people with disabilities want to have. So we're focusing help on those who most need it and helping those with disabilities who want to get into the workplace to do just that.
Well, I think this is the the fact is that many disabled people in poor communities do not vote Tory. And the desire to punish these people is actually quite popular amongst swing voters in marginal constituencies. And that underlies all of this. And I think we've mentioned the film I, Daniel Blake, which I went to see the other week. And I think there's actually an element within the Tory party that actually likes the idea of punishing people when they're poor. And they know that that actually gets some votes in certain communities that they're keen to...
I mean, is that about deflecting the blame because the rich are not paying enough tax?
Well, I mean, when you think about the wealth of our society in general, the fact is that many employers do not want disabled people in the workforce because they'd rather not have them. And so the idea that the disabled should be made to work for their own benefit, even if it costs us more to make them work. I mean, don't forget the assessment procedures. We were talking about this earlier. The assessment procedures to decide whether people are available for work are actually highly expensive. And I would argue that in principle, and you see that in the film, I, Daniel Blake, the doctors have decided he's not fit for work, but the private sector providers of the reassessment decide that he is fit for work. I don't think the case cannot be made, to my mind, that anybody other than a qualified doctor should decide whether somebody's fit for work.
Tim,
nobody else should make that decision.
Why are we trying to force or persuade disabled people to go to work when we've got an increase in 12% of people aged 16 to 24 who haven't got a job? This is the so-called NEETs, not in education, employment or training. The number of those without a job is now 857,000. So that's over three quarters of a million of the youngest people can't get a job, and yet we're saying, oh, the disabled people are going to have to compete for it at all. The whole thing just seems like some kind of ridiculous marketplace where everybody is beating each other up to get the price down for a job. And of course, if the price is down for a job, then you can't pay the bills.
Well, I think a lot of disabled people do want to get a job if they can. The problem is that there's so much pressure on them to get a job, which often might not be appropriate given their disability. I think the problem is they're being demonised by the government. And we should remember, disabled people have a lot of backgrounds. What we often be told is people trying it on and trying to claim off the system. I'll give an example of another disabled person, actually one of my co-counsellors who was on disability benefits. She was on disability benefits because she was a serving soldier who was injured while serving this country, preparing for deployment to Afghanistan. So I think a lot of people need to remember those people also claiming benefits are there for some extraordinary reasons. Some of them actually were fighting for this country, and that's why they're disabled. So I think we need to fight back and say the demonisation of disabled people is unacceptable. And that is why the government is able to get away with trying to push these cuts through, because they have convinced the public that basically, people are trying it on. Actually, people are fighting with pain and agony every day.
I also think it's fair to say we shouldn't be demonising anybody who's unemployed. You're trying to compete with nearly three quarters of a million people who are just out of university and just out of school. How on earth are you expected to get a job? I mean, it isn't easy. It certainly isn't easy. And of course, all of this really, Martin, is about creating this vast pool of unemployed people so big employers can cut their wage bills.
Well, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when unemployment went over a million in Britain in the 1970s, and people were shocked and horrified, and a million unemployed, this is going to lead to riots in the streets. Even Tory MPs were shocked. But now we've got used to having at least a million unemployed.
Not riots on the streets, it's more people sleeping on the streets.
Well, yes. I mean, we've not had full employment in this country for a generation. And if there's not full employment, then you can't argue that everybody should get a job, because they can't, especially not if they are disabled. And, of course, the employers don't in Cuba, the disabled are all employed. But, of course, they don't have a capitalist system. Every employer has to have their quota of disabled people on their roll. But that's it's not a capitalist way of running it.
Maybe it's easier to get a job in Cuba. The other thing, of course, is when all of these basic things like housing, water, gas, electricity, all those things, food, are cheap, then society runs a whole lot easier, folks. Anyway, let's go back to the House of Commons again, where Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition Labour Party, had some questions about, social care? That's right. Very important topic, and something which local authorities were and are responsible for, but massive cuts to the budgets by central government.
Mr Speaker, Sir Simon Stevens said that, told us 2 weeks ago, that the next 3 years are going to be the toughest ever for NHS funding, and that 2018 would see health spending per person cut for the first time ever in this country. And the NAO reported that the cost of health tourism is over 100 times less than the 22 billions of cuts the NHS is facing from this government. The reality is, Mr Speaker, under this government, there are 6,000 fewer mental health nurses. There are a record 3.9 million people on NHS waiting lists. All of us who visit A&E departments know the stress the staff are under and that the waiting time is getting longer and longer. And that there are 1 million people in this country not receiving the social care that they need. So instead of looking for excuses and scapegoats, shouldn't the Prime Minister be ensuring that health and social care is properly resourced and properly funded to take away the stress and fear that people face in old age over social care and the stress that is placed on our very hard-working NHS and social care staff?
Billions of pounds extra into social care through the social care precept and the Better Care Fund. £500 billion being spent on the National Health Service. A record level of investment in mental health in the National Health Service. But there's a fundamental point that the Right Honourable Gentleman refrains from mentioning. It is this. We can only afford to pay for the National Health Service and for social care if we have a strong economy creating wealth. Precisely what he's going to hear from the Chancellor of the Exchequer in a few minutes' time.
Well, I think that's just wrong. A strong economy, if we're thinking about the demand in the economy, the people at the bottom, the people on who need social care, the people who are disabled, the people who are unemployed, the people in expensive private sector accommodation, if those people have more money in their pockets, that will boost the economy far better than ill-conceived massive infrastructure projects. For example, building Hinkley C, which costs a lot, but what is the effect on the economy? Because it doesn't actually, the figures don't add up.
And it costs us much more in electricity too, doesn't it?
Well, indeed. So in other words, getting the social welfare of the population right is not an optional add-on when you've got the economy right and then you've got some resources to spare for looking after people. Looking after people is fundamental, and it's fundamental to making the economy function as well. I mean, later on, if we won't probably have time to discuss the potential for things like basic income, universal income. So like universal credit, except instead of means testing it, you just make sure that people are looked after. And then you could have free public transport, free healthcare, free education, and most people wouldn't have to, you know, they could go through most of their lives without spending a lot of money at all.
We can, and we do have time for it. Scotland could trial giving each citizen a universal basic income. This is in The Independent this week. Development of a radical scheme, they call it radical, it's just common sense actually, which could see welfare benefits including child and tax credits replaced with universal flat rate payments due to be tested in Fife. Scotland could roll out the universal basic income pilot after a trial won huge backing from anti-poverty campaigners. Development of the scheme due to be tested in Fife will be discussed this week by councillors, civil servants and members of the Scottish Basic Income Network, and would see welfare benefits including child and tax credits replaced with a universal flat rate payment, Tim.
What worries me about the concept of the flat rate payment is it sounds very attractive and you think, okay, you can get rid of the bureaucracy and it gives everybody a guaranteed level of income. My concern is that, one, you might be giving money to people who don't need it, but secondly, my real concern is that those people who do need money and currently get higher rates would suddenly see drastic cuts. And that's where I am a little bit sceptical. I do want to just briefly mention on the NHS, I do think what was being said there is very important. I think we need to stop the debate, though, that we can just give the NHS free money. If we want the NHS to have more money, let's accept that involves a tax rise. And let's be honest, let's be upfront. That's what now the Liberal Democrats are saying. Put a penny on everybody's tax. All that money goes directly to the NHS and social care, and they can see where it goes. We think people would accept that because the NHS and our health and the health of our nation is so important, people will be willing to accept that increase. But I think, we need to win that argument now across the political spectrum.
Now, we did mention it briefly just now, but also homelessness came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday too.
Kirsty Blackburn!
Ah!
Mr. Speaker, Aberdeen Sirenians have launched a financial appeal because of the increasing numbers of people finding themselves homeless as a direct result of the UK government's pursuit of austerity.
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, how can the Prime Minister sleep in her warm bed at night knowing her government's policies have consigned people to a cold Christmas?
The government is taking action in a variety of ways to address the issue of homelessness. Of course, one of the key things we need to do is ensure that we do see more homes being built in this country. But I just say this to the Honourable Lady. She talks about austerity in the sort of tone that she refers to it. Actually, austerity is about us living within our means. We should always remember when we're talking about government providing support for individuals that taxpayers have to pay for that support, and many taxpayers are themselves struggling to get by.
Well, they certainly are, and they should be not be paying for the Queen, who should be living within her means, rather than taking £700 million of taxpayers' money for a refurbishment of Buckingham Palace. It was one of those things which really irks me to see. We're taking money away from people who have virtually nothing and giving it £700 million to the richest woman in the world. We had Kevin Cahill explaining how rich she is last week here on this programme. But all is not lost, because there is always the possibility of squatting, which is taking over an empty building because investors have bought them or whatever, and they're speculating on them. And actually there are quite a lot of squatting going on in Britain. And just to announce, there is a new squatter's handbook out. This is telling you your legal rights as a squatter to take over an empty building. You can't squat residential properties nowadays, and that's available for the princely sum of £2 from the Advisory Service for Squatters in London, and also from AK Press in Edinburgh. But back to the main point there, I suppose, Tim, homelessness, at the end of the day, is the big motivator, isn't it? When someone comes along and tells you, sorry, you're going to be evicted from your home, it's time you're going to have to act, aren't you?
Well, we get it a lot as councillors. We're approached by people quite often facing homelessness, and it is a really difficult situation. The council has very limited properties to offer people, and sometimes the advice of the council is fairly extreme, pointing out that people have to literally wait till the bailiffs come round. Otherwise, the council won't accept that you're homeless. We're seeing now a definite increase in street homelessness. We're seeing that amongst young people. We also, of course, see it amongst former servicemen as well. And I think what we need to accept is lots of people can quite easily get into a position of homelessness. Sometimes people are literally just one paycheck away from being homeless. What we now need to have is a far more fluid approach. We need to have flexible housing which can get people into. I think too much government's got into trying to specify how pristine a house has got to be. What people need is sheltered accommodation, especially during the winter months. Certainly at the council, I think that is being talked about more now. So rather than the idea of trying to find three-bedroom houses, having temporary accommodation we can get people into is a necessity. It's a great cost to the council, so we also need help from the government to be able to do this. If we can get people into accommodation, we can then help them deal with the situation that got them on the street, and hopefully we can bring them back into society where they'll actually then be paying taxes and working, and in the end we all benefit.
But Martin, this is a great motivator, isn't it? If someone comes along and says, listen, you're going to lose your home, you're going to do something. You're going to do something fast, aren't you?
Well, one of the things about universal credit, which Tim was mentioning earlier, is because of his desire to sort of improve the poor, IDS insisted that the universal credit and housing benefit payments would no longer be paid directly to landlords. They would be paid to individuals who would then pay their landlords so that they would learn how to manage their money. But the response of the private sector to that, including Tory supporting private landlords, was, in that case, we're going to kick out all of those on benefits from our properties, and we want people who are in work in those properties. And I was caught in this trap myself a couple of years ago, because I was on benefits at the time and I found it virtually impossible to rent a private sector place. Now, in other words, that's just an administrative decision which has made it so people can't get social housing because they haven't got the priority. They can't get on the housing ladder. They can't even get into the private rented sector because the private landlords, unless they're paid directly, aren't prepared to put those people up. And that means they end up on the street, which means that, and as I understand, and Tim will correct me if I'm wrong, there's more money being spent by the Bristol Council on putting people in bed and breakfast as a result of them ending up on the streets through this kind of process, so which is more expensive than housing them properly.
Well, this change is just coming in, but thankfully we've managed to get an exception for public sector housing, so social housing, but only, of course, when someone's got a couple of months into arrears. So already social housing landlords are projecting this will cost them millions of pounds a year. And what they're saying is they know which of their tenants will not have the structure in place to be able to meet these costs, but they have to wait until they get into trouble before they can act.
So why are they doing it, Tim?
Well, this is very much a philosophy approach, I think, of the Conservative government. I think where they're wrong is they think everybody should take control of their lives. Yeah, well, some people need help.
Some people can't. Simple as that, isn't it? Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're going to discuss ranked choice voting with Professor Rick Luttman. We're also joined by journalist Greg Pallast. We'll be talking about the latest with election recounts, potential fraud, and more. Later in the program, activists Nadia Tanos and Damanjit Singh report back from Standing Rock in North Dakota. Please stay tuned to the Project Censored Show.
Can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for a mighty dollar bill.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. On today's program, the first part of the show, we're going to be talking about ranked choice voting. We're going to be talking about alternative ways of expressing our votes and having voices heard in our purportedly democratic republic. We're also going to be joined by Greg Pallast. So Peter will introduce our first guest, Professor Rick Luttman, here momentarily. But we're also going to be joined by journalist Greg Pallast. And Greg Pallast, of course, is no stranger to the program. Greg Pallast is the Rolling Stone investigative reporter. His new film, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, was released in September, and he's going to be laying out how Donald Trump can and would and maybe did steal the election. But before we get into that discussion, here is Peter Phillips to properly introduce Professor Rick Luttman. Peter?
Rick Luttman is a longtime friend, and he's a professor at Sonoma State University, emeritus in mathematics, and he has done a fairly extensive study on ranked choice voting. Rick, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you. You just did a two-hour lecture on ranked choice voting. We, of course, don't have 2 hours today, but what are the main issues that are faced here?
Well, the problem is that we use a system of voting in this country almost exclusively called plurality voting. And what that means is that regardless of how many candidates there are, each voter is asked to select one. Then the first place votes are tallied, and the person with the largest number, even if it's not very many, wins the election. Now,
but that didn't work.
Well,
this time.
The thing is, if there's only two candidates, there's not much to say. Somebody will have a majority, and that's the winner. But as soon as there's three or more, there can be problems. One problem is that the voters might decide that they kind of equally support all the candidates. Not saying there'd be ties exactly, that's not very likely, but somebody might win with just a little bit more than everybody else, and most of the other voters said, no, we like somebody else. So one of the and by the way, there's other problems too with this plurality system. Surely we've all had the experience that there's a candidate we like, but we recognize that our fellow voters might turn that person down, and it'd be somebody else. But we'd like a chance to express an opinion about these others. So we have a second choice, and if that's eliminated, we have a third choice, and so on. So the idea of ranked choice voting is that we give voters an opportunity to say not only, this is my first choice, but this is my second, third, fourth, and so on. Now, having said that, I haven't specified exactly what the voting system is going to be, because there's still the question of, well, what do we do with these ballots once we get them? And there's a number of ways we can go. One of the most popular alternatives is instant runoff voting. It's actually in use here in the Bay Area, the city of Berkeley, where we're speaking from today. Also Oakland and San Leandro, as well as San Francisco across the Bay, all use a variant of instant runoff voting. It's used in other places. The state of Maine just voted on November 8th to use instant runoff voting throughout the state. There are some other ways of dealing with ranked choice ballots. One I like is called the Bordeaux count, named for an 18th century French theorist, Jean-Charles de Bordeaux. It's not in use in civic elections in the United States, to my knowledge, but it is commonly used in the sports world to do things like pick a most valuable player or to rank college football teams.
So, Rick Glutman, we seem to have maybe better or potentially more democratic ways of selecting selecting candidates or ranking whatever it is we'd be voting for. You just gave the example in the sports world. So apparently it's important enough that it's used elsewhere, but not in, say, our presidential elections or congressional elections.
To my knowledge, the Bordeaux count is not used anywhere in civic elections in the United States. It is used in some other countries. Instant runoff voting, as I mentioned, is fairly common among those that are not using plurality.
So if we'd had instant runoff voting here in California and someone wanted to vote for Jill Stein, then their second vote would go to whomever they wanted, and presumably Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
But then you wouldn't have been blocked and you only had a choice between one or two, or if you get blamed for not letting somebody win, you know.
Yes, well, I was talking to a lot of people going up into this election who were in a conundrum. They really didn't like either of the two mainstream presidential candidates, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. They would prefer to vote for somebody else, such as Jill Stein running for the Green Party. But the problem is, if you vote for Jill Stein, you don't get a choice between Clinton and Trump. So you're in a conundrum. You could stick to your principles and say, I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. I'm through with voting for the lesser of two evils. But you might be tempted, to, on the other hand, to say, no, I really like Jill Stein better, but
especially,
I know she's not going to win.
If it was in Ohio or someplace.
Well,
we're going to get back to this, Rick.
Yeah, actually, let's, you know, but there's other problems. You know, ranked choice voting certainly would be giving us more options. But let's tune in to Greg Palast here. Greg Palast is joining the program. And, of course, I introduced Greg. Greg's no stranger to the audience and no stranger to the show. Rolling Stone investigative reporter. His latest film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, was released in September. And it lays out how Trump, could and would, maybe did steal the election. And Greg Palast, you have a recent piece at Truth Out, the sort of the no-nonsense inside guide to the presidential recount. Sorry, no Russian hacker hunt. So, Greg Palast, you're back on the Project Censored Show.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I'd like to be with you, but, you know, it's like meeting at a funeral, you know. It's something you don't want to do too often.
Yeah.
I mean, my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, I say at the opening, this is how Trump plans to steal the election. It's a crime in progress. And
here,
you know,
we are.
Not where you don't want to be right on something like that. But you know, it's I'm laughing because, oh my God, he did, you know, it was almost like he watched the movie and said, hey, that's a good idea. Here's how we do it, guys. Here's 10 ways to steal the vote.
Yeah, like 1984 is not a user's manual, right?
I sometimes, you know, I often worry about that when I do these investigative reports. People think, that's a good idea. So there's no question from my investigations
which you see in the film and for Rolling Stone, then the follow-up since the election, is that in fact the various types of ways that we don't count ballots in America. I mean, that's the secret of American voting. I was listening to the professor before, and it's great if we have this system of voting where you get the, you know, your second choice, so you don't have to pick the lesser two evils, but you express your views, etc. That's great, but that also assumes that we count the votes, which would be very unique for America because we don't. Okay, and so the reason I've been talking to Jill Stein and, more important, her chief attorneys on this investigation, on the recount, and at gregpalace.com and truthout.org, I have an article trying to give you a guide to what this recount is about. And it's about that issue of, it's not a recount. I think that that's the wrong way of looking at it. I call it the first count.
Right.
We literally have millions of votes in America that are not counted at all. Millions. Okay, this is not, by the way, Greg Palast with a tinfoil hat on getting a message from another planet. This is from the United States Elections Assistance Commission, which is designed to attract, compile not only the votes that are counted, but the votes that don't ever get counted. So they fall into basically three big piles. First is are the absentee ballots. You know, really, we have about 35, 40 million people who mail in their ballots, and about 1.5 million of those never get counted for all kinds of cockamamie reasons. Wrong postage. They didn't like your signature on the outside. The wrong envelope. You folded it wrong. Extra mark on the ballot. You put a check mark next to the candidate's name and said, fill in the little bubble. I kid you not, 1.5 million citizens, they mail in their votes. They think that they voted. Well, you know, when you go postal, it's very, it's an interesting gamble about whether your vote will get counted. Then there are the provisional ballots. You know, most white people, unless you were in the California primary, have never seen a provisional ballot. Given out like candy to voters of color, these are ballots that, as I explained in my film, I call them kind of placebo ballots. Why? Because they make you feel like you voted, but you haven't. They throw out about a third of them. 2.7 million officially in the 2012 election, 1 million were thrown out. That's the official number. 1 million ballots thrown out by American citizens, cast by American citizens. I would say it's double this time, probably close to 5 billion. And part of the so-called recount is trying to get those votes counted in the first place. And the absentee ballots that were rejected for cockamamie reasons to get those counted in the first place. And then a group of ballots called spoiled. So the Stein campaign is trying to pull those ballots out of the electronic dumpster, the electoral dumpster.
Right, and you call these overvotes. Overvotes, undervotes.
Overvotes, yeah. Undervotes. And people may not know what an overvote and an undervote is. It's real simple. If you overvote, for example, in Milwaukee, apparently a lot of people in Wisconsin, Michigan, voted for two presidential candidates. Hey, it's kind of like what the professor is talking about, your two choices. But the truth is, no matter how bad Detroit schools are, people do know that there's one president and you get to only vote for one. So why all these votes for two presidential candidates? The answer is the machines. They use these optical scan readers. You darken in, you use a special pen, or you darken in with a pen, your choice for president. If they decide that there's an extra mark, if the machine says, oh, there's an extra mark on the ballot, that then both candidate choices are thrown out. People don't vote for two candidates. They just don't. And the human eyeball, this is why we have the so-called recount, is to count those ballots that were thrown out and not counted. And also a lot of ballots were left blank. Now, if it's random, who cares? In fact, according to Trump, despite the fact that he's trying to block the recount, he's afraid that it's going to go against him. So he's blocking the recount after saying, oh, if you really counted all the votes, I'd be the winner. He should welcome the recount because it Absolutely. Would mean that he won the popular vote, too. But instead, he's sending in his lawyers to block the whole thing. To block a review of these votes. Again, these are not recounting. These are counting. Most of the work is counting votes that weren't counted in the first place. And so
And that, as for example, the overvote, you vote twice for president, that's baloney. A human eye would see that someone didn't vote twice for president. The machine was miscalibrated, the card went wrong into the machine, etc. Then there's the undervote. People wait in line an hour to vote for president and vote for no one. Come on. People don't do that. So you have a massive non-vote, a massive number of blank ballots. You know, and it's not, this is not some grand protest that's going on. Rather, it's, again, the machines that are misreading it.
And Greg Palast, you know, we're going to take a quick musical break here, and then we're going to come back with you and Rick Luttman. But it doesn't include the potential for hacking or the software that's used in these other computer voting. I mean, there seems to me that there's all kinds of ways that things can go awry. But we're going to get into more of that, and we'll come back with Greg Palast and Rick Luttman to talk more about voting and election issues after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Helf with Peter Phillips. That's a little Iron and Wine there. Perhaps many of us want the latter here. Given the conversation we're having today, we're having a conversation about ranked choice voting. We're also having a discussion about the recount, or as we were just quipping prior to the music, a first count for some of the ballots and the vote. We're joined by Professor Rick Luttman, who math professor emeritus at Sonoma State University. He's talking about ranked choice voting. And we're also joined on the phone by Greg Palast, the investigative reporter for the Rolling Stone, who in fact has done a lot of work recently. His film Best Democracy Money Can Buy came out September and was laying out how Trump might be able to steal the recent presidential election. But Greg Palast has been talking about the issue of ballot bandits and more for many, many years. So this is not just about, I mean, granted, we're talking about the recent presidential election, but this goes back some ways. But let's go to you first here, back again to Rick Luttman. And we were just speaking during the music break. You wanted to make a few more points about the ranked choice voting and provisional ballots. Rick?
Yeah, thank you. Well, one of the things I do in my spare time is I volunteer as an election official. I started doing that several years ago because I really wanted to see what it looks like from the inside. And I have to say, in all fairness, that there are some good reasons to give out provisional ballots. Many people come into the polls and they're in the wrong place, or they really didn't register, or they're from another county or something like that. And it's unfortunate, but there's good reasons why you're supposed to vote at where you're registered. Now, this is not to say that there aren't a lot of phony problems, too, but I just wanted to point that out. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to point out that the issue that I was talking about before, about what kind of system we use, it's important, but obviously it doesn't make a damn bit of difference what system we are using to count votes for people who don't get to vote at all. And we've been having a very serious problem recently with Republicans all over the country passing these laws that make it much more difficult for the people in demographic groups that normally don't vote Republican to get into the polls, they have to have IDs and so on. And, of course, votes that that are not counted, they're cast, but they're not counted. Again, it doesn't matter a damn what kind of system you're using if you're not going to count the votes.
All right, well, Greg Palast, you've talked a lot about caging and vote suppression, and the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act from 1965 not long ago. What do you have to add on that front?
Well, in this election, 1.1 million voters were knocked out by a gimmick that I just, you know, that I uncover, watch me uncovering it real time in my film, which is a system called CrossCheck. And this is the latest game that they use. So it all begins with claims of voter fraud. Donald Trump says the election's rigged. People didn't listen to the second part of his statement. The second part of his statement was because there are people voting many, many times. What he meant was that people are voting, for example, in Georgia and they're voting in Ohio. Well, the same person. Well, that's a hell of an accusation, that and he says a million people are doing this.
Yeah, and 3 million apparently in California. Illegal immigrants, he claims.
Yeah. Well, he claims that there are a million people swam the Rio Grande to vote for Hillary. He hasn't found any. They found one illegal alien, and if you get caught, you get. And this guy was sentenced to 10 years. It was an Austrian registered as a Republican. That's the only case of an illegal alien that they
can't trust those Republicans, can you?
So they. There's always some crazy person does this, but they use this to blockade real voters. And as I say in my film, we had 181,000 voters in Florida accused that supposedly they're illegal aliens, people that like swam from New Mexico to Orlando to vote. And it's basically Puerto Ricans who, when the island went into bankruptcy, 250,000. Fled to Florida. They're U.S. citizens who can vote within 30 days of arriving, but they have a lot of vowels in their last name, so they're obviously illegal aliens. And they try to remove 181,000, but they convicted one. So they use this as excuses to remove voters. This was huge in Arizona. One of the main reasons why Arizona supposedly went for Trump was by basically knocking out the votes of legal Americans accused of being aliens. Many were accused of voting twice under this cross-check system. And I kid you not, they have on this list, it's in the film, you have Maria Hernandez votes in Georgia, and then Maria Hernandez votes in Louisiana. And they say it's the same voter, but it's Maria Cristina Hernandez and Maria Isabel Hernandez. But as far as they're concerned, that's not a common name, Maria Hernandez, because it's not common for a Republican. No one has challenged this system. Finally, I got the attention of the ACLU and the attention of the NAACP, which after the election they're suing now to reverse this system. And you have the Congressional Black Caucus. I will say that 2 months before the election, Congressman Alcee Hastings wrote a letter saying, look, Greg Powell's evidence, which is published in Rolling Stone and shown in his film, is solid that they are removing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of voters under this false claim of, you know, there people are voting twice. But look at the names, 288 people named James Brown in Georgia. Believe it or not, they found people named James Brown registered in other states. And they said, aha, James Brown is voting many times. James Edward Brown is supposed to be the same voter as James Thomas Brown. They had James Brown Jr., James Brown Sr. is the same voter. This is, you know, in Rolling Stone, it's all over BBC and the European stations, the South American stations, top of the nightly news in Buenos Aires. But in America, you can't get this word in anywhere. This was a Jim Crow election. This was a Jim Crow election. 6 million votes. In 2008, Bobby Kennedy and I, writing for Rolling Stone, calculated that there were 6 million votes not counted or people, legitimate American voters, blocked from voting. This year it will be bigger.
Greg,
and the guy
Greg,
in charge of this vote suppression effort, by the way, Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, is going to be, and put your money on it now, is going to be Homeland Security Chief under Donald Trump.
Boy, Greg, give us an update on what's going on in Wisconsin and Michigan. Challenged. Wisconsin, they've said that it's go down to the local county level to decide. Does that mean they won't count? They won't physically go in and count the undervote or overvotes? Or
this is a big problem because there used to be a nonpartisan panel of judges that would decide how to run recounts and review the vote. That was replaced this year by Republican Governor Scott Walker, who put in a committee of hacks. Well, it was pretty hard for them to turn down the request of Jill Stein,
for a recount, and they charged her $3.1 million to begin. But then they said, well, it's up to each county registrar to decide whether Stein's volunteers can actually look at those ballots again, see if an overvote was baloney, the machine read it wrong, just look at it. Is the ballot good? Instead, they said, it'll be up to each county chief whether whether Stein's people can look at the ballots, and they can either, they can say, blow off, and we will look at the ballots ourselves, or even do something. We won't look at the ballots. We'll recount by, you know, just sticking it through the same machines that got it wrong in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you basically get the same result. So this is what I'm looking at. And, of course, the mainstream press does not want to, you know, they want to be focused on things like whether there's Russians in the software. And, you know, it was Hillary Clinton who brought up this Russian stuff, this Cold War idea of the hack attack on the vote rolls from abroad. Let me tell you, you don't have to tell Wisconsin Republicans how to fix the vote. They're pretty good at it themselves. They don't need someone from Moscow giving them advice.
Yeah, well, that, it's again, it's anything to cast attention away from the incredibly tepid, weak neoliberal campaign that was run here top down from the Democrats. And it's also interesting to note that we don't have time to open up the can of worms here. But the DNC vote rigging with Bernie Sanders, that's the vote suppression that took place in the primaries. I mean, here we see Trump with mass suppression going on in the national election. Greg Palast, do you know anything going on in terms of it was rumored that there was some talk in Arizona with the Secretary of State there and talking to other states, some 30 other states, about the voting issues and electoral college issues. Do you know much about any of this?
Well, look, Trump is doing everything he can to let the Electoral College roll on December 19th without any changes or challenges. He's panicked because if you look at that pile of uncounted votes, he lost. And you know that because the exit polls were quite clear in not only those three states, but in the seven swing states where Hillary Clinton won clear majorities in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And
lost by 2.5 million nationally anyway.
Yeah, but even in those swing states.
Right.
And so the difference between the exit polls and the official count are these, if you add it up, it's accounted for, not by some guy in a cave changing the votes. It's accounted for by the votes that were never counted. People who showed up, they were cross-checked because Maria Hernandez shows up and her vote is, she's told she's not registered anymore.
Right. Well, Rick Luttman,
she gets a provisional ballot,
right,
and then they throw it out the window. Or you have an absentee ballot. And Wisconsin played a wonderful game. If you came in for early voting, and early voting is always Democratic voting. It's souls to the polls day from the black churches on Sunday before the vote. They know it's Democratic voting. So Wisconsin, rather than let people cast regular ballots, which are automatically in the machine, you can't challenge them once they're in there, instead they made everyone doing early voting cast their ballots as if they were absentee ballots. They literally made them fill out absentee ballot forms, stick their votes in an envelope. Now, the reason they do that, in fact, one voting official who was steamed about it in Ohio told me, it's real simple. They want to count early votes as absentee votes so they can challenge them and come up with any cockamamie excuse. You know, you left a line blank on the outer envelope. Like, for example, if you write, it says, put in your driver's license, you don't have one. If you leave it blank, you lose your vote, as opposed to you're supposed to put no driver's license. But if it's blank, because you don't have one, you lose your vote. Welcome to America.
Right.
The idea that Joe Biden says that we are the envy, that our electoral system is the envy of the world. What world has he been in? Kazakhstan?
Rick Luttman, let's bring you back in here.
Thanks, Mickey. I just wanted to say about a word about Bernie Sanders. As we've been hearing, he probably won the Democratic primary, or would have if it had been done fairly. But let's take up where the Democratic convention ended. Clinton was given the nomination for the Democrats. A lot of Bernie Sanders supporters wanted him to run as an independent. He decided, and probably is a good decision, not to do that because it would virtually guarantee the election of Trump. Now, my pitch is if we had some better system of voting where people could express a second, third, and so on choice, this wouldn't have been a problem. Bernie Sanders could have run as an independent candidate, and people who were concerned that if they voted for him, they're throwing away their chance to decide between Clinton and Trump, wouldn't have had that problem. They could say, my first choice is Bernie Sanders, and if he's eliminated at some point, then my second vote goes to Hillary Clinton. I also wanted to add, by the way, that there I'm not necessarily pushing independent, instant runoff voting. It's one system that we could use. There is no perfect system. That's not just an opinion. There's a mathematical theorem that says that. And there are problems with every system. But I think it's pretty clear that the worst system of all is the plurality system that we use. And almost anything would be better than that. Something that would give us a chance to express a more nuanced opinion on the candidates than just this is my favorite and hell with the rest.
Well, it's the case, too, that if you look in, internationally, the United States has been ranked pretty much near last as far as election integrity of democratic countries. And just even speaking here for the last half hour with Greg Palast, Rick Luttman, you've given us a lot of reasons why that might be, but also what there could be in terms of some solutions or better type systems. But then again, Rick Luttman, we go back to Greg Palast, and that doesn't matter either if you're not counting the votes. So, Greg Palast, we have just a minute here to finish up this segment. Last words from you.
Well, get unstupid, find out how they did it, because I laid it out, the 10 ways to steal the vote. So go to GregPalast.com, and you can actually see the cartoon that shows you the 10 ways that they cancel your vote. It's in that article of the No BS story, the recount. And by the way, you can now get from Amazon for a couple bucks the best democracy money can buy. It's unfortunately more relevant now than ever. So that's the thing. You have to know how they stole it to stop the thief.
And Greg Palast, that's the book you're referring to, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaire and Ballot Bandits. That the book, anyway, Seven Stories Press.
The movie is available on Amazon for a couple bucks.
Oh, right on. So if people can go and grab the movie now and see exactly what you're talking about, in addition to reading everything you're doing online. And Ted Rall did some great cartoons for you.
Yes, and so in the film we have lots of cartoons by the guy who did the Who Framed Roger Rabbit. There's cartoons in the book, and we even have, if you go to GregPalast.com on the far right, go down the column, you can get a free comic book of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy with Rosario Dawson and Willie Nelson, all those people actually in the comic book as well, not just the movie. So there's lots of ways to get unstupid and pass it on to your cousin who voted Trump in Iowa.
Well,
so, this is a good gift for Christmas is the information.
Well, Greg Palast, thank you so much for joining us again on the Project Censored Show. Rick Luttman, last words here on the
I just wanted to point out that the federal constitution is really silent on how elections should be run. The framers were very concerned about not infringing on states' rights, and so they left everything up to the states. There's nothing that even says there has to be elections. It's state constitutions that do that. So my point is that we can work within our states and to some extent within our local jurisdictions to try to create voting systems that will give us a little bit more flexibility and that will eliminate some of these.
And where would people go to find more information on Reich's choice voting?
I would suggest just Googling IRV or ranked choice voting, or the Bordeaux count is a good place to look.
And we could do that here in California for the whole state if we chose to.
Yes. In fact, there was a movement earlier this year in the state legislature, which unfortunately failed. In my opinion, it was unfortunate, to give local jurisdictions the right to use something like instant runoff voting. The cities here in the Bay Area that use it are charter cities, and they have a little bit more flexibility to set their own rules. But this bill that failed in the legislature would have allowed any local jurisdiction to conduct elections in some other way than this dreadful plurality system.
So, Professor Rick Luttman, thanks so much for joining us to talk ranked choice voting. And also, of course, we thank Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. We're going to take a brief musical break, but when we come back, we're going to be joined by two activists that are just back from Standing Rock in North Dakota. Stay with us.
Portland is a town that's in the news much of the time. There are a lot of vegans and there's very little crime. It's a nice, safe place to live. Folks ride bicycles a lot. The winters aren't so cold and the summers aren't so hot. They build houses out of cob. They hang out in the park where you needn't worry about walking after dark. There are lots of homeless people, but they don't hurt no one. Just be careful of the boys in blue playing with their guns. Yeah, watch out for the cops. 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 You can hang out with the punks with the piercings and tattoos. You can eat out at a food truck any neighborhood you choose. You can dance to Balkan music while you drink a microbrew. Chilling in a gay bar with the mayor and his crew.
That was David Rovics telling us to watch out for the cops. And we are joined now by two activists that are probably going to be talking a lot about that issue, because they are just back from Standing Rock in North Dakota. And we are joined by Nadia Tanos, who is a community activist and writer located in the San Francisco Bay Area, Ohlone Nation. She is the local general coordinator of Palestinian Youth Movement Bay Area Chapter, tour coordinator with Friends of Sabil North America for the upcoming tour of No Child Behind Bars, Living Resistance from the U.S. to Palestine. Nadia, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thanks for having me, Mickey.
We're also joined by Damanjit Singh, a community organizer and educator in Northern California Sikh community. Teaches Gatka, the Sikh martial art to Sikh youth from Bay Area at Fremont Gurdwara. And Damanjit, you are also back from Standing Rock.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for the two of you for being here and taking time to share what you're going to share with us, because it's very important that people hear, again, firsthand what's actually going on. The corporate media ignored much of what was happening with Standing Rock at first, and then have had entirely distorted and biased coverage of what's been going on there. So let's just hear from the two of you. I know there's a lot of things you want to talk about, from decolonization to indigenous sovereignty, but let's just go ahead and jump in. Nadia, talk to us about what you saw when you were there and the things you want to share with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for giving us this platform to report back. We've both done it individually to our communities, but it's great to get on the air and, you know, talk to others. I mean, I think the first thing to remember, there's so much news coming out of Standing Rock. A lot of it is really skewed and some of it is quality. But I think the first thing to remember is that the No DAPL struggle is anti-colonial and anti-corporate at the heart of the empire. It's in the belly of the beast, and that in itself is really powerful. So just to keep that in mind and a premise, I mean, I think going back to Standing Rock, this is my second trip there. I was there in September, and seeing just what sort of violence was being used against the protectors there was really one of the most shocking things.
The water protectors,
mm-hmm.
right? Yes.
The water protectors, mm-hmm. yes. And, the levels of violence, they come in so many different ways. I mean, most obviously is the physical aspect of it, which is, you know, the LRAD, the usage of the LRAD on the front line, on the bridge on Highway 1806, which really shook the nation. There was a lot of coverage of that, mainstream and non-mainstream, just because it was so egregious to use this machine that has been used by the U.S. military on their assault in Iraq, you know, and to use it against civilians here, to have that literally come home was just astounding. Also, they're going after your respiratory system. They're going after your vision with the mace. they're going after your nervous system by freezing you. I mean, there's a full-on assault of your senses.
It's a full-on military assault against indigenous peoples and the people standing with them, and that is for the Dakota Access Pipeline, which was rerouted, right, away from Bismarck because the white population there said, well, this might not be a great idea for us. But as we've seen far too long in the United States and even before that in colonial, literally, America, the British colonies, there was a relentless onslaught and genocide of Native Americans, indigenous populations. And if you go back to 1500, the population was reduced by some 98-odd% by 1890, 1900. And the fact that this is going on now, while President Barack Obama was pardoning turkeys for Thanksgiving and declaring Native American History Month, is absolutely stunning. That there's this level of ignorance and callousness is amazing, really.
I'd like to have either of you describe the camp right now. How many people are there? We're understanding several thousand.
Yeah, about 10,000, I think, since Thanksgiving.
Wow. And then there's many veterans arriving this weekend.
Right. About 2,000 came yesterday.
Oh, my heavens.
Yesterday morning, yeah.
So that's a whole lot of folks.
Right.
So this isn't just, you know, a few dozen Native Americans trying to have a sit-in on a highway. This is a whole lot of people building a city, literally. And we also understand that you could be fined now for bringing materials in support of the encampment. The Ace Hardware store up there was refusing to sell propane.
At the behest of the sheriff's office.
Right.
The sheriff's department actually bought up, I think, 200-some rooms in the casino this last weekend to prevent people from staying over in the casino, using it for showers, using it for other facilities.
Wow.
Taxpayer money.
Now, yep. You were in a protest, and you were shot. What happened there?
So Megan and I, who's another young woman from the Palestinian Youth Movement, we actually met over there through Nedia, and we were running around on the front line passing out hand warmers. Hand warmers are these small heating pads that once you open them up, you shake them, they're activated by oxygen, you put them in your pocket, put them in your gloves, keep you warm, keep you dry. And so the water protectors, mostly Native homies that were in the front, holding up the barricades, holding up plastic shields, holding up tarps, were getting their hands blasted by water cannon. So they're dealing with frostbite, pretty much hypothermia. As soon as the water hits, it turns to ice. So we're passing this out, and so I came from one barricade, I was moving forward into the next barricade, they were kind of staggered. And as soon as the cop saw me, he popped down from the water cannon, popped out of the side door and hit me with his rubber bullet like he was playing paintball with me.
And he looked right at you and kind of smiled. Hey, I gotcha. Oh, boy. And now what's that feel like, getting hit by a rubber bullet?
Well, I'm a martial artist, right? So we get hits with sticks a lot of the time. So it reminded me of, like, you know, getting cracked really hard with a heavy staff on my shoulder. Left a huge, huge welt, huge bruise, even like a week later.
And some people are being shot in the face with these.
Right. People were bleeding from the head, from the temple. One woman got hit with a flashbang.
And,
that exploded into her arm.
Her arm, young woman activist, and was struggling to save. They were struggling to save her arm. Nadia, you were there. What did you see?
So Damanji and Megan arrived at the scene earlier on the bridge. And so by the time I got there, the LRAD had already been used and the majority of the pepper spray had already been sprayed into the air. You could still smell it. And the water from the cannons, when it was blasted out and it froze, there was this weird oily residue because they had mixed mace into it. So not only are they using, you know, mace is actually a chemical compound. It's not really a gas. Like what we think of. So it's actually aggravated by water, by H2O. So in Palestine, for example, when we're hit, we usually use Coca-Cola if we don't have milk of magnesia around. But the thing you should not do, for example, is take a shower because it aggravates the burn. So they're already kind of, there's a lot of foresight that I think we saw on that night of how, you know, to really calculate the brutality that was used against us. Also, I mean, we were trying to warm ourselves on the different fires that had been made out of wood far away from the line, not using property to be burned. And I mean, there were firefighters in full clad, you know, gear as a civil servant, right, quote unquote, shooting these water cannons and putting out the fires, literally making it impossible for people who are facing hypothermia out there to rewarm their body back up to temperature. I mean, it was calculated.
This one would think that, that certainly what you're describing sounds criminal on so many different levels, right? Here you two are, I just was thinking when the two of you were talking, and Damanjeet, when you were talking about you running on the front lines with your friend Megan that you had met there. It reminded me of just, you know, the first part of the program today. We were talking about the fiascos with the election and recounts and fraud and other alternatives to this system. But one of the things that was going on, by the way, the DAPL was ignored pretty much in the campaign, right? Bernie Sanders, of course, has recently been saying much more on that front. But both the major parties have said next to nothing. Right, about what's going on here. And it reminded me of the relentless diatribe against millennials and how millennials aren't doing enough and they're apathetic, and Hillary Clinton campaign blames millennials for not voting, and she's the 800th reason why she didn't win because it had nothing to do with her campaign. It's pretty stunning because I'm sitting here looking at you two, millennials, right? And a lot of young people that are traveling there, like Peter's student Noah that we had on by phone, he was going to try to join us today but couldn't. He was also shot. This is pretty amazing. And I think it's remarkably insulting to an entire generation of people to pretend that you're not doing these things and to pretend that you're not on the front lines of social justice movements.
Totally. And I think there's this invisibility kind of our agency and our contributions to society. But I think the larger, you know, something that's even magnified by this, Mickey, is the fact that, you know, this is a movement. The No DAPL struggle is a movement started by Native American women in particular. And it started, you know, Sacred Stone was started in April of this year by Indigenous women. Oshati Shakawin, the overflow camp that is being threatened with eviction by the Army Corps of Engineers on December 5th, was started by Indigenous women. You know, so many of these movements inside the camp were started by Indigenous people. And this is a movement really by Indigenous people, for Indigenous people. Us as millennials, I mean, Damanjeet and I are Indigenous to other places, but, you know, we are born here, not of Native American blood, but yet here we are, and it's our duty to witness that resistance. I mean, witness in a way in terms of contributing to it, being a witness to it, taking, you know, following Indigenous leadership and saying, what can we provide you? What can we do? What do you want us to do?
This seems like it's a confrontation, not just about Native American land, but building this pipeline anywhere, whatever direction they take, putting it in the Missouri River. Invariably, that's going to leak. Or there will be problems with it. So it sounds like we've got several thousand people, 10,000 maybe this weekend, with the possibilities of many, many more arriving to completely prevent and shut down this pipeline, period. And that's a major confrontation between corporate power in the U.S. and people of conscience.
And purportedly the co-option of public authority through the governor and the Army Corps that are saying that they're evacuating, right? They're pushing to, they've put a date to forcibly evacuate, Damanjeet.
Right, that just goes to show the violence is so full scale, right? We're not just talking about police brutality. We're talking about full-on siege in the coming weeks, where they might they'll certainly have roadblocks on the south of 1806. They already have it blocking 1806 north. They'll have roadblocks, checkpoints coming in. People won't be allowed to. There's not going to be freedom of movement, freedom of supplies, medical services. So we're talking about full-on siege. The violence over there is so diverse, it's so variable, even beyond the rubber bullets and the tear gas, in terms of the way knowledge is being suppressed, freedom of movement is being suppressed.
I could see thousands and thousands of people saying, this is where I make a stand, and making a move to be there in a variety of ways, however they can. And that's that we're looking at a really serious confrontation here, it seems like.
Indeed. And you know, while we're talking about the metaphorical fascism of a Donald Trump, let's remember that this is a real manifestation of a fascist militarist action happening under the Obama presidency. And he is saying very little to nothing of what's going on in this situation. Not yet.
I mean, September 9th, so I showed up the first time at Standing Rock in September right after Obama and the Department of Justice had made that statement about halting construction along the Dakota Access Pipeline. And, you know, people, there were 10,000 people on September 9th when he made that statement. And by September 11th, about, you know, there were 7,500 left, which is a good amount. But the moral of that story is that it was a tactic, right? The DOJ, when they said that they were halting construction, they meant only on a certain, you know, a very small amount of area on a certain place in the pipeline. Construction continued.
So we're going, I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're joined by Nadia Tanos and Damanjit Singh, just back from Standing Rock. After this brief musical break, we will come back and we will talk more about what's going on in North Dakota. Stay with us. David Rovics, why don't they play your songs on the radio? Well, David Rovics, we just did. But the real problem is that that kind of music, that kind of message doesn't get out on the so-called people's airwaves hijacked by corporations for profit. And, of course, at Project Censored, our job is to tell the news. It doesn't make the news. And we're joined here by Nadia Tanos and Damanjit Singh, who are just back from Standing Rock. And they're telling us a lot of things that are not on the television. Of course, some of the things have been covered, and some of them have been sensationalized. Many of them in corporate media have been spun or redirected and reframed away from, you know, some of the core issues that we're talking to you about here today. And we only have about 8 or so minutes left in the program, but we wanted to get to the idea of indigenous sovereignty, and we wanted to talk about environmentalism, of course. But I know, Nadia, both you and Damanjit want to make a point about each of these issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about indigenous environmental issues, many dominant engagements with that phrase forgets about the indigenous part, right? Like, so... I think it says a lot that people are so ready to stand behind clean water and clean air, right? And that's seen as really progressive, but they are quicker to do that than stand behind the equal rights of another human being, and particularly the human beings upon which this nation was built off of. You know, as being a settler colonial nation, we profit off of the oppression of Native peoples every single day. We benefit from that every single day. Even people like Damanjit and myself, whose ancestors were not here a couple hundred years ago, we were born here. We are settlers by virtue of the fact that we are not Native, and we benefit. We're privileged based off the oppression of the Native peoples.
Right, and that's why it's critical to understand that NODAPL needs to be a decolonial, anti-colonial movement. Environmentalism and all these other isms sort of seek to make contemporary society more efficient, more better for the people that are already in it. But what that will never deal with is the brutalization faced by black and brown bodies, by indigenous people, the fact that their lands are still being stolen from them, etc. It's really critical that we continue to center indigenous sovereignty, indigenous lifeways, indigenous people through this struggle.
Yeah, and I think just a really quick point about that is that decolonization doesn't have a synonym, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a substitute for human rights or social justice. Like, decolonization is based on an indigenous framework. It's centering on indigenous sovereignty, ways of thought, land. And so if, you know, we go up to the NODAPL protest and we're talking about clean water and air for everybody, that's fantastic. But that's the hinge, right? The point is indigenous sovereignty. The Army Corps of Engineers is giving an eviction notice to Native people, to Lakota people, to evict from their land. This is treaty land from Fort Laramie.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is an act by a settler colonial nation. We have no thought here about what that means, just the hypocrisy of
and
it.
And the history of it, 400 broken treaties, over 400 of these. I mean, this is again what I mentioned earlier about how it was just so astounding. I mean, it's almost like in many ways from the presidential election to this issue, it's almost like we're in some kind of time machine back to the 19th century somewhere where this kind of stuff was in the process of completely normalized. But here we are in the 21st century, and you know, Nadia, you just said decolonization. I mean, I've never heard that word in the corporate news media, and I've not heard it from members of the political class, the plutocratic class in the United States. That's for sure. Damanjit, you want to?
Right, because they're invested in keeping society as it is and sort of propagating their own power. Power wants to reproduce itself.
That's amazing. Yeah, now we have several thousand people that are camped out up there. Describe the living situation in the camps, and one of the critical things, of course, is staying warm. And in the middle of the Dakota winter, there's snow. I mean, you know, so it's really that's difficult. Let alone getting sprayed with water and freezing. But what's life like in the camp? And is there adequate food? Is there adequate shelter and medical care, that sort of thing?
In terms of food and winterizing supplies, there seems to be plenty. One of the critical things that we're now dealing with through December and probably into January, if this continues, is the supply of firewood, which is now also going to be targeted specifically by the Sheriff's Department, by the National Guard that will be having their checkpoints through the area. They're actually actively blocking firewood across state lines and entering into the camp.
So, Damanjit, thank you for sharing all of your experiences and also for, you know, risking your life to be in this place, and you were shot and you were attacked. And thank you for coming back and sharing this information with everybody. They definitely need to be hearing. People need to be hearing these narratives and be part of this story.
It was an honor to be able to stand with the indigenous people here and take part in what is also our tradition and their tradition of resistance.
Yeah, Nadia Tanos, we have about a minute left. I just wanted to give you the last opportunity here. If you maybe even share a little bit more, and then maybe if there's any place people can go to get more information or to support what's happening.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of sites, you know, like there's the official camp websites and things where you can go and get basic information. I myself usually go to the Osheti Shekawan page just to check out what's going on. I think the important thing is, you know, in terms of donations, what Damanjit just said is 100% true. We need to focus on firewood. It's really being targeted, and that's, I mean, what I think we're struggling with. How are people going to get through the winter without firewood to heat up the teepees and the tents? Myself, because I'm one of the coordinators for Palestinian Youth Movement, as is Megan, who Damanjit mentioned earlier, we are in the middle of the second PYM caravan of Arab Americans and Palestinian youth up to Standing Rock. So if anyone has an interest in kind of getting more information, our donations that we receive, we are sending directly to elders. We're not sending it through the main institution of the camp, and we have reasons for that. But I think, look up the PYM caravan online, and it will come right up.
Okay, thank you, Nadia Tanos. Thank you, Damanjit Singh, for joining us. We have two brief announcements. Peter?
This Sunday at 11:45 on the 4th, there is a march in support of the fights up in Dakotas, and it's at Julia Park at 11:45. Going to march to City Bank.
Also, like to announce Tuesday, December 6th, Aquas Cafe, downtown Petaluma. The Project Censored lecture series continues. Investigative sociology and social justice in Sonoma County. To learn more, go to www.projectcensored.org. Project Censored Show is produced today by Dev Ross, who is also our engineer. Thanks so much for all of your help, Dev. I'd like to thank Robert Manning. Thank all of our guests. Thank you for tuning in. The Project Censored Show airs on 36 stations around the U.S., most recently in Columbus and in Nashville, Tennessee. Please check us out on Facebook. Follow us. Like us and send us your thoughts about the program. We will see you next time. Stay tuned for Terra Verde. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Standing Rock Water Protectors are receiving eviction orders. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the North Dakota governor issued 10-day notices to Osheti Shakowin Camp. This program is being recorded on November 29, 2016, less than a week before a December 5 deadline set by the Army Corps of Engineers, as well as the governor of North Dakota, to vacate the several thousand inhabitants of Osheti Shakowin, the most significant camp of the water protectors at Standing Rock. The Standing Rock protests began in the spring of 2016 in response to the construction of Energy Transfer Corporation's Dakota Access Pipeline. It is designed to carry oil extracted by fracking. The pipeline would run from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota to southern Illinois, crossing beneath the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, as well as part of Lake Oahe, next to the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. In April 2016, LaDonna Brave Bull Ellert, a Standing Rock Sioux elder, established the Sacred Stone Camp. It was meant to be a center of spiritual resistance to the pipeline. Her intent was to protect the burial sites of her family and her people. Over the summer, the camp grew, with additional camps forming nearby and at times holding up to 10,000 people. In spite of media silence or outright lies, the camps gained recognition, material support, and visits by indigenous peoples from across the world, as well as environmentalists and quite a few well-known celebrities. Amazingly, such diverse and fluid populations continue to form close unity over the principle of nonviolence, that water is life, and a resurgence of the recognition of indigenous sovereignty. All activities, both the ongoing construction of the pipeline as well as the land that is used by the water protectors, as they want to be known, are on the territory of the Great Sioux Nation that holds use permits, if not outright title to the land, according to the treaties of Laramie. However, broken treaties, military force, and federal as well as state agencies that ironically use the indigenous name Dakota for the colonial constructs that now lie on top of one's sovereign territory are now making use of military, police, and legislative power, all in order to push through a pipeline project that has the potential to poison the water of those who rely on the Missouri and Mississippi rivers. Here's one voice that sums it up, a shout-out and message to the outside world recorded inside of one of the camps, with the sound of all the assembled humanity and the Dakota winds in the background.
It's far beyond ironic that we're being persecuted protecting our land that was stolen from us. Our people are tired and sick. Our people are done with sacrificing our self-determination for the profits of billionaires. It's infuriating to look at hills that have our ancestors buried there. Sacred ground, burial mounds, carrying our grandparents. And we're told that we can't walk there, that we can't pray there, that we can't put our bodies on the line to protect for it. That pain runs deep. Where this pipeline is proposed across the Missouri River is within the designated area of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. That land was designated for our usage, land that was stolen from us by the United States government, land that was sold to white farmers and ranchers, and then resold to a multi-billion dollar corporation, Energy Transfer Partners. It hurts so deeply that in the same place that our ancestors struggled for their lives, we're still struggling today. What's changed? Nothing's changed. We're still struggling for our lives here. We're still struggling for the future.
That's Dallas Goldtooth. He's Dakota and Dene, and a Keep Fossil Fuels in the Ground organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. As this is being recorded, the water protectors in the Standing Rock camps are unsure if police or military force will be used for an eviction. Some say, including the tribal chair of the Standing Rock tribe, that the Army Corps and the state only want to warn the camps of the serious North Dakota winter with wind and snow. Others point to the recent extreme violence that was used by the police and led to several permanently disabling injuries among the water protectors. They fear that violence will be used again. One day after the eviction notice from the Army Corps of Engineers, a press conference was held in the Osheti-Shakoban camp. I took the audio from two of several films that were streamed live to social media. Behind the makeshift outdoor table for the conference, you can see the huge, several thousand people strong camp stretching far towards the surrounding mountains. You will hear seven different voices, from youth to elder, from activist to spiritual leader. The wind is blowing. Surveillance drones are overhead. Even the sound of a helicopter makes it at one time a little hard to understand. But please stay with it. The first voice is a young woman from the Indigenous Environmental Network. When the IEN formed in 1990, they began annual conferences on the grounds of Indian tribes that were dealing with serious environmental issues, be it abandoned uranium mines, toxic dumps imposed on them, a gold mine trying to seize their territory, or a corporation trying to drill into Sacred Lake for thermal power. As I'm recording this on November 29, groups from across the country are now traveling to Standing Rock for support and as witnesses, including a group of 1,500 veterans. They had made their travel plans weeks ago and refused to back off. They want to be human shields. But whatever will happen on eviction date, the dreams and hopes and values of those whose voices you will hear now, will not be extinguished. He is Osheti Shakoban Camp on the land of the Great Sioux Nation.
Okay, everybody, hello. Dosha Marugua Marushima A Ishuwehet. So I said hello, relatives. My name is Eagle Woman. I'm Mandan Hiradzo Rikara from Newtown, North Dakota, just northwest of here, and I work with the Indigenous Environmental Network. We'd like to thank you all for coming here today on Saturday, November 26th, and experiencing this global warming here with us today. We want to talk about response to the Army Corps of Engineers letter that was received yesterday, as well as some other things during this month of November, which some of you may or may not know is Native American Heritage Month. And we're going to offer perspectives from the Youth Council with Tomas Lopez. We're going to offer perspectives from Continuation of Youth, but also Sacred Stone Camp here with Aaron Weiss, Dallas Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network. We want to hear from some of our spiritual folks in the spiritual piece, which Isaac will bring in for us. Some of the actions pieces and kind of what we've been framing with Nick Tilson here. And we'll end with comments from Tribal Chairman David Archambault. I'm going to have each person introduce themselves, and we're going to start with Tomas.
Hello. Thank you all for coming here today. Thank you to my elders for asking me to come and speak on behalf of the International Indigenous Youth Council. My name is Tomas Lopez Jr. I'm from Denver, Colorado. My mother is Sharon Dominguez Lopez, and my father is Sundance Chief Tomas Lopez Sr. I am here to talk about the past few hundred years and the many broken treaties that have occurred. We've been lied to for over 500 years, and we're here to request that President Obama honor his word that he made to the Standing Rock Youth when he came here in 2014. President Obama, when you came here, you promised that you would protect tribal sovereignty and spiritual belief. You promised to protect our sacred way of life. And here we are today standing up for that sacred way of life. And where are you? You are in silence. You mentioned nothing on your Thanksgiving Day. You spoke nothing of us or to us. Many of our council members on the International Indigenous Youth Council, if not all of the members on the International Indigenous Youth Council, have experienced the brutality that has come from the Morton County Sheriff's Office and also the National Guard, from broken limbs, injuries from flash bombs, internal bruising, and the everlasting consequences and results of PTSD. I'm asking you now, President Obama, if this were happening to your daughters, Sasha and Maria, would you say something? Or would you stand in silence and let them brutalize your own children? On behalf of the International Indigenous Youth Council and our allies and all youth around the world, we are asking that you step in now and assist us in stopping the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Sanjo, my name is Koestiwe. My name is Aaron Wise. I come from the Hickory Apache Nation in Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico. And I am here to represent my aunt, LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who is the founder of the Sacred Stone Camp. When my auntie came in April, she told me that her intention was not to set up a camp that looked like this. Her intention was to stop people from putting a pipeline in the place before her son's grave. She said that she wanted to ensure a peaceful resting place for her son, and she did not think that when she started her camp it was going to evolve into this. She's grateful for it. But on behalf of Sacred Stone Camp and my aunt, we went to Washington, D.C. last week, and we met with the general of the United States Army Corps of Engineers, and he looked me in the eye, and I told him what happens in the dead of night when people aren't watching. I told him of the prevalence of rape culture in the United States, and I told him what happens to people that are left unprotected. Right now, our land is to be left unprotected if we are to leave this space. And being a woman that has survived sexual assault, I just want to say that we are not going to allow that to happen to our mother. We stand with all women who have been hurt, but we especially stand with our mother who is continually hurt and sanctioned by the United States government that hurt is a continuance of the hurt that has been brought upon us for the last 500 years. We're not going to stand for it anymore.
I also want to say to President Obama that, you know, in light of what Tomas said, the indigenous youth are calling upon the United States government for protection. They're begging for people to start caring about them. We have 3 times the national rate of suicide in any other community. We have children that are killing themselves every single day because they want to be a part of this country so badly, but they are continually ignored. And, you know, my aunt who stands behind, you know, our youth councils here and who is a grandmother and a mother herself, you know, she does represent the sacred here, you know, and the children are what we need to protect. We need to think about them going forward. And I think that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers needs to remember that these are children that we are protecting, and that if they continue to support Morton County and the North Dakota state government, that they are not protecting the children that they are responsible for. I would just ask that whoever is watching this that is in power, you remember the children, and you remember that we, as sacred people, as prayerful people, will continue to make our stand. Done.
My name is Dallas Goldtooth. I'm Dakota. I work with the Indigenous Environmental Network. And I first and foremost want to acknowledge our relatives who traveled from afar, and also acknowledge our relatives, the Humpapa Oyate, and relatives from the Standing Rock Sioux Nation, who invited us to this land, and we are their guests, and say acknowledgements for that. I also wanted to say that we have our relative, our sister organization, Honor the Earth, couldn't be here at this moment. They had a representative supposed to be planned to speak, but they, 4 of their vehicles had all their tires slashed this morning in Mandan up in North Dakota. And so their vehicles are incapacitated. And it just demonstrates the environment in which we are in right now. This letter by the Army Corps of Engineers is just a disgusting continuation of 500 years of colonization and a systemic oppression. And it's absurd for us to see such a declaration a day after Thanksgiving. But that's the state of the affairs that we are in. It doesn't matter whether you're Dakota, Lakota, Nueta, Saanish, or Cheyenne. This is the land our ancestors are from. This is the land where our ancestors dreamed of our existence, of our songs, and of our future lives. And in defense of those dreams, in defense of our ancestors, we stand strong. We stand strong to protect the sacredness of Mother Earth. We stand strong to defend our rights as indigenous peoples. And we stand strong to defend our territorial treaty rights as Ocheti Shakoin Oyate. That's the stand that we make, and we continue to stand by that. This movement that you see before us is not a movement of hate, but just a movement of undying love for our land and our people in the water. And that's what we're here for, and that's what we're seeking to. So thank you very much.
Government chajeki as a quest of machapi. Oglala and Matahana. And now I can understand Adewaiki. Ernest Western Senior Macha Echiapi. I'm a Dakota Sioux Nation, and I represent my Oglala Lakota people. We brought back the Ocheti Shakoin, and the fire is lit. And there's representatives here from all 7 council fires. And our biggest concern is the Army Corps and the United States government needs to honor our treaties. From the 1851 to 1868. So these are our lands, and we have treaty Indians here who are here to enforce that treaty. The Army Corps of Engineers, they aren't our landlords. As it states in the treaties that us as the Ocheti Shakoin, the Lakota people, we are the wardens of the land. This is our land. They can't remove us. They need to respect our treaties and respect our rights. In violations of Executive Order 13-647 that Obama signed himself in 2013, that they have to honor our treaties. They have to honor our rights as indigenous people. And in Executive Order 13-007, we have a right to be on federal lands. in which we can pray. And these lands that we stand on, there are old Sundance grounds, there are old Vision Quest sites, there's old burial sites here. We have every right to be here and protect our land and protect our water. Oh.
No.
My name is Nick Tilson. I'm from Porcupine, South Dakota, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, Oglala Lakota, father of four children, and I'm here representing the Indigenous People's Power Project. We've been here since August, helping the camp ground ourselves in nonviolence and in nonviolent direct action. To date, we've probably trained over 3,000 people in this camp in nonviolent direct action. Because nonviolent direct action is connected to our Indigenous values of prayer, and we were told in ceremonies that we needed to continue to do what we do, founded in our Indigenous values and founded in nonviolence and founded in prayer. That if we stay nonviolent and we stay prayerful, we will win. And I would like to remind Morton County, remind the Army Corps that we are unarmed. We've been unarmed and will continue to be unarmed. We are only armed with our prayers. We're armed with our bodies. We're armed with our faith that we have and what we're here to make stand. And every time that we have done action, every time we have taken action, we have done it based on these values. And we will continue to do it based on these values. But we have been met with aggression. We have been met with violence. That violence has been put upon us. And this eviction notice continues to show the United States government and the Army Corps of Engineers and Morton County's ability to escalate to a point of violence. That's not our goal here. Our goal here is to stay peaceful, to stay prayerful, to stay focused on what we're here for. And that's stopping the Dakota Access Pipeline. They have an option. In the next 10 days, we are calling for them to deny the easement, to permanently stop the Dakota Access Pipeline through treaty lands. And this camp will continue to be grounded in prayer, in nonviolence, in nonviolent direct action. These are strategies that different movements around the world have been taking for generations, and we are borrowing from those different movements and combining them with Indigenous values that we have here today. And so we ask that Morton County and the Army Corps of Engineers be honest, tell the truth. When they see us coming forward, when they see us at these actions, when they see us making a stand, they see us in prayer. They see us peacefully, but they have been acting aggression upon us. And so we are asking accountability for the violence that's been portrayed on our people. And our grounding in spirituality, the reason why there's not guns in this camp, the reason why there's not alcohol and drugs in this camp, is because we don't bring those things to Sundance. We don't bring those things to ceremony. We don't bring those things because it doesn't align with who we are. That's how strong our commitment is here. And we understand that our ancestors are here with us, that we're not alone, that's who we have to be accountable to in the work that we do. And it's part of our very identity of who we are, and that's why we're here. And we will continue to remain peaceful. We will continue to remain nonviolent, and we will do it with strategy. But we want America to know that as Indigenous people, we are not victims. This movement exists here because we are powerful, because Indigenous people have reclaimed power, and because we have been doing it through our Indigenous values.
My name is Dave Archambault. I'm the chairman of the St. Rock Sioux Tribe, and I just want to thank everybody for their continued commitment and continued sacrifices that they're making to build the awareness that is happening. When I got the letter from the Corps of Engineers, the first thing I read was for public safety. The Corps of Engineers is saying that the weather is coming, the harsh winters, so they're aware of that. And then the continued confrontations that are escalating with between the law enforcement and the water protectors are becoming more and more unsafe, and some serious injuries are starting to take place. So because of that, they sent a letter. And if they want public safety, the best thing for the federal government to do is to deny the easement. The best thing for the government to do is to step back and really analyze what has happened. So to stop this all, what we need to do is to ask the federal government, ask the President of the United States to deny the easement and to continue to stand behind his words when he says we need to recognize the treaties.
The youth started this. The youth ran. They ran in their own community, and they were like, we feel good. So what should we do next? And then so they ran to Nebraska. And they went to the Corps offices, and they said, we don't want this. They said, we feel good. What should we do next? We're going to run to D.C., and we're going to reclaim all of this as Indigenous youth. They started it, and it's only fitting that Tomas here gets to have the final words at this press conference.
Again, thank you to my elders for allowing me to speak. The Standing Rock youth were the ones that started this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I wish that my brothers and sisters were here right now and we could all speak, because their stories are so important. Their stories are the story of Standing Rock. They are what will go on to the future. These are the stories that are going to be heard. What we are doing here as the youth is we are ensuring that our tomorrow is safe. We are ensuring that our tomorrow still exists, that the next seven generations can have the same drinking water and the same air and the same earth that we did today. We don't want to have to explain to our kids one day what clean drinking water tasted like. To touch a bit on what you said about people being brutalized, what I want to tell everybody is that for the past 500 years, these people and these mercenaries that this government protects have been controlling us. They've told us what to do, and we've almost given them the reaction that they want. And what we're doing here at Standing Rock is telling all of the oppressors around the world that oppress Indigenous people, we will no longer give you what you want. We stand as a rock. And when a river meets a rock, it will move it. But when the rocks stand together, the river will go around it. When I was arrested in Bismarck for praying, for exercising my First Amendment right, the Chinese proverb came into my head, no matter which way the wind howls, the mountain will never bow to it. And what I want everybody in that racist, white supremacist group to know is that not only do we love you, but we will not be moved by you. Do with our physical bodies what you want, but you will never, ever have our souls, have our spirits, or have our hearts.
Aho!
That was Tomas Slopis from the International Indigenous Youth Council. Before him, you heard Eagle Woman from the Indigenous Environmental Network. They spoke at a press conference held in response to the eviction notice by the Army Corps of Engineers and later the governor of North Dakota. They want the several thousand people living in the Osheti-Shakovan camp to vacate by December 5, a notice period of 10 days. The press conference ended with an honor roll of the names of those who had been seriously injured or were imprisoned during the attacks by the police on the water protectors. To have targeted Osheti-Shakovan camp is a very serious matter. Osheti-Shakovan is the proper name for the people commonly known as the Sioux. The original Sioux tribe was made up of seven council fires, and the fire has been relit in the camp and kept burning in memory of the history and culture and stewardship of the indigenous Sioux over the lands that are now North and South Dakota, including parts of Montana, Wyoming, and Nebraska. Water is life. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Ah!
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen about his book, All My Bones Shake, and society's four fundamentalisms that we need to deal with to move forward in a healthy way. So stay tuned.
We are privileged to have as our guest Dr. Robert Jensen. He teaches media law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Get Enough, The Heart of Whiteness, Citizen of the Empire, and Right in Dissent. His latest book is All My Bones Shake. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jensen.
Great to be with you, Sylvia.
At the root of the current political economy and ecological chaos is a national religious unrest that is thwarting our self-awareness and slowing our spiritual progress to a glacial crawl. This is a quote from the cover on your book. In our society, we seem to think of religion as the belief in some type of deity, whether that be a Christianity religion, Muslim religion, or any kind of religion. I would argue there seems to be another religion, and that is the religion of the marketplace, where we accept things as the natural result of the marketplace. And you actually covered this in your book. So for our audience, where does this come from? Where does this blind faith in the market come, and how does it manifest?
Well, of course, you're right that we talk about religion and spirituality and faith and the things that define us. But in reality, in the contemporary United States, and the truth is it's blanketed much of the world, there is a kind of market fundamentalism, an economic fundamentalism that not only claims capitalism is the best way to organize an economy, but claims it's the only way, it's the natural way. It's an attempt to make a set of human choices about how to distribute the wealth of the world as if they were natural, as if they were beyond critique. And that's a kind of core definition of fundamentalism, a belief in a set of principles with absolute certainty in a way that can't be challenged. But of course, an economy is a set of human choices. Why do we accept this market fundamentalism? Well, part of it is simply the effort that has been put into a propaganda system by mostly a relatively small elite to get ordinary people to believe that the incredibly unequal distribution of wealth in the world is somehow unavoidable. But of course, we know it's not. And we know that we have within our grasp, if we were to do so, ways to devise an economy that would not be perfect, that would still require a lot of struggle, but would not produce the profound inequality which now structures the world economy. I would just remind listeners that as we speak, about half the world's population, according to the World Bank, more than 3 billion people on this planet today live on less than $2.50 a day U.S. for everything, food, shelter, education, medical. That is, half the population lives in a kind of abject poverty. I would want to believe that that is not our only option, that there are other ways to devise an economy. And I think, paradoxically, although in this country many people who identify as Christians also accept this market fundamentalism, I think Christianity is a source of resistance to this fundamentalism. And in the progressive fashioning of an understanding of Christianity, I think there is a lot of hope.
One of the things you address in your book is you say there are four fundamentalisms. So I wonder, you talked about the market fundamentalism and how we see this invisible hand sort of fixing everything and the market dictating the choices. So it implies that citizens have choices. So perhaps we should start by addressing the issue of choice then, because if you are a Haitian, your choices are very different than if you are a worker in Canada or the U.S. So how is this constructed and maintained, this myth of equality and democracy in our society?
Well, of course, first of all, we should recognize that within the contemporary corporate capitalist system, it's not a complete myth. There is some freedom to choose, and there is some movement from people who begin in low socioeconomic places and rise up. That is, there is a kernel of truth to the notion in capitalism that anybody can make it. Certainly there are people who were raised poor who became wealthy. Certainly there is some level of choice in the system. But the question is, does everyone have meaningful choices with the kind of equality that makes it possible to truly choose? And the answer there is, of course, no, because capitalism has been and always will be, from my point of view, a wealth-concentrating system. And kind of the lie of capitalism is the idea that everybody can make it. But, of course, the system is premised on not everyone making it. And when we look across time and space, we see that historically, that relatively small elite, which has for the most part been concentrated in the first world, in Europe, the United States, Japan, a few other places, has used its power. It's used force, violence, coercion. It's used all of that to maintain that inequality. Well, I think when you step back and look at the whole system, one sees that capitalism is, in fact, inconsistent with democracy, because the way capitalism concentrates wealth leads to a concentration of political power. One can see that capitalism is inconsistent with our own principles and values about what it means to be a human being, a belief in the dignity of all people, a belief in equality. And for those reasons, I think capitalism is fundamentally incompatible with Christianity. I think to take seriously the text and the tradition of the Christian faith is to be anti-capitalist. And in fact, if one looks back at the early Christians in the first two or three centuries after Christ was killed, you see that many people in that era believed that to be a Christian was to live communally, to share, to renounce private property. Well, that's not capitalism, in case anybody isn't clear. Right, so the Christian tradition itself is rooted in a rejection of the inequality and materialism that defines capitalism. I think the principles of Christianity, when appropriately understood today, would lead to a rejection of the current capitalist system. And that's why in the book I try to root myself in that Christian tradition, which is the tradition of the culture I come out of. And I think the struggle to define what that Christianity means is very important.
You brought two very important points, and I think that's how religious has been sort of thwarted to be in favor of capital and economic fundamental principles. And I just want to point out that I recently interviewed Bruce Gagnon. He pointed out that, you know, with the election of President Obama, everyone was celebrating a shift and change. And yet, he says, you know, in 1 year, President Obama has done what no other Republican has ever done in the history of the U.S. And he turned $12.3 trillion in bailouts. Nine out of every $10 was given to the banks. And I'm reminded of the story in the Bible where Jesus spoke against this. And this idea that we accept certain policies blindly, I think, needs to be addressed. I'm trying to reconcile the fact that we take this as a, you know, without challenging. On one hand, we say the bailouts needed to be given. Why? Who profits in an economic crisis? Who's profiting out of the massive military budgets that are being issued? So it seems to me there's a structure behind this. Can you speak to this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Of course, in times of crisis, there is always a push on the part of elites to define the crisis as unmanageable without immediate action from the top. And, of course, sometimes that's true. If your country is being invaded by another country, perhaps that might be true. But with an economic crisis like the one we just lived through, or are still living through, there was another option, and that option was to rethink the fundamental nature of the system, to use the crisis not simply to shore up and reinforce the inequality in the existing system, but to ask, is this a moment where we can devise something new? And that can happen with the input of everyone. There could have just as easily been a process when the subprime mortgage crisis hit to convene a kind of national conversation about what we want in an economy. And I think that the reason that didn't happen was not because it was impossible, but because people with power didn't want it to happen. And I think the tension around this is mounting. Ordinary people increasingly, even people who 5-10 years ago would have endorsed the capitalist system in the United States on the assumption that it would provide for them, are now seeing that the people who run that capitalist system really don't care about ordinary people, and that ordinary people are starting to push back and to recognize their real fate in that system. Now, I think the real important moment for those of us who consider ourselves politically active or organizers or community activists is, can we marshal that resentment into positive channels to challenge the system? Barack Obama happens to be the guy running things at the moment, but it's not the guy running things at the moment in Washington who really holds power. It's the people who control the productive capacity of the country, the capitalists in that sense, the owners and the high-level managers. And we have to challenge them. And then eventually, if we're successful, we give the Barack Obamas of the world a choice. You either sink your fate in with the people, or you ally yourself with the wealthy and the privileged, and it's a choice then politicians have to make. You know, all of this is a long-term struggle that's been going on for decades, centuries, in which ordinary people have been trying to take control of our own lives. And this is a moment where I think there are things possible precisely because of the crisis.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the fundamentalism, this fundamentalism that you speak of in your book, of the state, this nationalism that promotes or sometimes blinds people to the actions of their government. How does this unfold? And you know, because it seems every empire has always justified whatever crimes they commit as being in the interest of the people, this sort of benevolent empire. How does it manifest, and why should we be aware of it and fight against it?
I think you're, again, hitting on an incredibly important subject, especially here in the United States, which is kind of the empire of the modern world at this point. As you point out, most imperial powers in the past, whether it was Britain, France, you know, for a brief time Germany, Russia, they often justified their crimes around the world, the crimes that exploited the resources of other places and oppressed the people of those places. They justified those crimes as somehow being in the interests of advancing civilization, of civilizing the natives. These are very, you know, obvious justifications and failed justifications. Of course, no serious person would believe them today. Yet here in the United States, we have our own imperial justifications, mostly around the idea of bringing democracy to other parts of the world. Well, we have to break down that fundamentalism, that sort of unthinking acceptance of a set of principles that really don't conform to reality. Does the United States bring democracy to the world? Well, I think we can look across the board, especially in the post-World War II era at U.S. interventions, and see that, in fact, the United States has done more to thwart democracy in other parts of the world than to advance it. So we, just as we have to break down the notion that markets and capitalism are inevitable, that fundamentalism must be challenged, so must the fundamentalism around the special role of the United States, the idea that the United States, by definition, is always doing good in the world. Well, a lot of people in the United States hold on to that fundamentalist notion as well. And I think all we're saying is that, you know, reality does not conform to fundamentalist notions. Reality is complex. Reality has a historical base that we have to try to understand. Reality includes an honest accounting of power, privilege, and oppression. And when we do that, of course, the fundamentalism melts away, just as I think it does in the religious arena, that when you fully understand the complexity of the human experience, it's hard to hold on to fundamentalisms. And that's what we have to do, is kind of ruthlessly tell the truth about this country, this economy, and our place in the world.
your book also talks about the technological fundamentalism, and I want to address this because we are living in an era of, particularly in Latin America, of incredible aggression. We see the coup in Honduras taking place, and the world has stood up and denounced the coup. And in many cases, we defend these policies as this developmental idea. And technology sort of goes hand in hand. But I think technology in the interest of whom? And technology for whom? So what do you mean by the technological fundamentalism? How do you see it being counterintuitive to a society that is inclusive and pluralistic?
I think here the critique and concern about a kind of high-energy, high-technology life is rapidly spreading. The one thing we know without question is that the fundamental health of the ecosystem that makes our own lives possible is in dramatic decline, and that decline is overwhelmingly because of human intervention into the ecosystem in ways that are not sustainable. It's the way we farm. It's the way we extract materials from the world. It's the way we dump toxins back into that world. Everyone understands, at least everyone who's willing to tell the truth, that we have created a system based on the high energy potential of coal, oil, and natural gas and the technological advances that have come with that, that we based a system on an unsustainable relationship to the earth. Now, what I call and others have called technological fundamentalism is really the belief that whatever problems have come from that high-energy, high-technology world can be fixed with simply more high-energy, high-technology. And you see this over and over again. We talk about the energy problem, and there is a scrambling to believe that we can invent new ways of creating as much energy as coal, oil, and natural gas have provided, even though that's an extremely contentious claim. We see the problems created, such as global warming, you know, the loss of the ozone layer, all these things. And instead of asking a fundamental question, which is, should human beings adjust the way we interact in the world, lower our expectations for energy use and consumption, to try and bring our way of living back into some sort of balance with the larger world, that question is never really considered. And all that we talk about in the dominant culture is how to find new high-energy, high-technology solutions to the problems that high-energy, high-technology has created. And that may end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism. I think, you know, religious fundamentalism is dangerous. We see the negative consequences when people have an unthinking belief in the absolute righteousness of a religious system. We talked about the problems of market fundamentalism, of national fundamentalism. But with technological fundamentalism, unfortunately, we're not just talking about the inequality within the human family. We're talking about whether the human family can continue to live in any sustainable way on this planet. And so many of us are concerned that this reflexive technological fundamentalism, this belief that technology will always save us, whether that might end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism of them all.
I think in society we tend to be selective as to what we consider to be important. And one of the ways militarism has been able to advance is by creating this fear of the other in society. And who are the other? Those who we do not recognize being equal to us or similar to us, whether that be skin or language or, you know, whatever we define as different. What do we lose when we ignore inequity, injustice in the pursuit of our goals for development or an improved quality of life? What do we lose in the long run?
Well, I think the answer is quite simple. We lose our own humanity. Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality. Yet the material comfort with which we live often allows us to ignore that. But I think when we do ignore that, in a very basic way, we lose some of our own humanity. And here, I think, is a place where traditional religion actually can help. Because if you think about whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, all of them are, at their core, I believe, are a call to recognize the universal nature of the human family. That is, all of them include principles that remind us that the value of my life, sitting here in the United States today, is of no greater or lesser value than the lives of people across the world. That person who might be living in sub-Saharan Africa on less than $2.50 a day, that person has the same moral value as I do, that person's child has the same moral value as my child. That is the universalizing call of religion, and it's clearly at the core of the Christian faith. Now, the problem, of course, is that religion can also be a way in which we distance ourselves from other human beings. That is, religion, although I think it is a call to the universal, also often leads people to draw the artificial boundaries you're talking about. Well, there's me and my group, the good Christians, and then there's all the sinners out in the world. And you can see how religion is, from my point of view, perverted to create barriers instead of break down those barriers. But again, I think that's why, for those of us who have an interest in struggling over the definition of Christianity and other faith traditions, we have a lot of work we can do not to invent a new religion, but simply to say it's time in the prophetic sense, that it's time to honor the true values of the religion, to honor that universal conception of the human family. All of that's within our grasp. There's a tradition, there's a text, there's a space that we call church where we can come together and do this. And I think that's, for me at least, the animating spirit behind my own interest in religion.
You, in your book, talk about power over in a dead world. What do you mean by power over, and what are the alternatives?
When we think about the question of power, in conventional terms, power is defined as the ability to make people do what they would otherwise not do. I have power over you, Sylvia, if I can make you do things you would otherwise not do. And that's what we tend to call power over. And of course, power over is real. It operates in the world. It often has disastrous consequences. But we can also think about power as power with. That is, my power is not over you, it's with you. It's in the collaborative, creative possibilities of you and I combining forces. And that's a different sense of power. That's the power, I think, that makes it possible to imagine a decent future. The power over, I believe, can lead only to a dead world. And I would make the argument right now that in the United States, given the values of this national fundamentalism and the market fundamentalism, often connected to a very reactionary religious fundamentalism, I would describe that as a dead culture, a culture that has no capacity to generate creativity and to generate life. All it can do is extract from others, which leads to death. So I know it sounds rather perhaps dramatic, but I really do think in many profound ways in the contemporary United States, we live in a dead culture, a culture that hangs on to ideas that are no longer consistent with reality, that hangs on to systems that are not consistent with a decent future. And I think we have to create something new. My own view is that that's not likely to happen in Washington, D.C. or on Wall Street in the centers of power. It's going to happen at the margins in places like Austin, Texas, where I live, where, you know, as we speak, we're working to acquire a building for a new community center. We're working to create some worker-owned cooperatives where people can control their own economic life. We're talking about resisting, you know, racism and sexism. We're talking about coming together in this sense of power with, not to control each other, but to try and find ways to create something new. And that's where I think the real hope for the future lies.
What do we need to create this new society that you describe?
Well, I think we need a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue. No, I'm kidding. That's the solution to everything in Texas. Just get a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue and everything will be fine. What does it take? Well, I think it takes, first of all, a kind of honesty to confront the very dire circumstances we find ourselves in. And beyond that, I think it takes a sense of hope. And by hope, I don't mean unrealistic, overly optimistic assessments. I think, you know, people have used the term a kind of stubborn hope, a hope that won't give up even when things are looking bleak. And I think we should tell the truth. Things do look pretty bleak in this country at the moment. Much of the population is in the grips of these fundamentalisms. Yet I think that we rescue our own humanity, especially those of us with privilege. And I have a lot of privilege. I'm white. I'm male. I'm professionally educated and employed. You know, the way I'm going to save my own humanity is not by holding on to my privilege or holding on to my resources. It's going to be coming into spaces where I willingly give up those resources in a collaboration with others. That's how we save ourselves. You know, sometimes people look at the political work I do and they think somehow I'm this very noble person. And the fact is, I'm probably the most selfish human being I know. I do this work because I want to, in a sense, save my own life. I want to create or help create a world in which I can be fully human. And the world we live in right now does not allow that. The world we live in closes off so many avenues for us to express our own humanity. It keeps us trapped in the corporate world. It keeps us trapped in conventional politics. It keeps us trapped in a commodified commercial culture that is always telling us to buy, buy, buy.
I was speaking to a journalist from Honduras. Gerardo Torres is a young man who started a movement called Los Necios, the stubborn. And they speak precisely what you're talking about, this stubborn hope, this idea that although you are constantly told you don't have a right to have those dreams, he says we're going to have them and we're going to define those who tell us we do not have the right to pursue a society with dignity and, you know, just a decent quality of life. What inspires you? What inspires your work to continue to struggle?
Well, I can tell you that's very easy. What inspires me is the people like you just described. Here in Austin, I've been incredibly fortunate to work with people, often younger people, people from what we call traditionally minority communities, people from parts of society that are not as wealthy, and I watch them struggle against much greater obstacles than I face myself. And I see them struggling and struggling joyously. You know, as someone who's older and more established and materially in a much more comfortable position, what I've discovered is when I go to those people and say, I want to join you in your struggle, I want to commit my own time and resources to the projects that you have going, that, as I said, I benefit tremendously. This is what gives my own life meaning. It's what deepens my own sense of my own humanity. There's inspiration every time we turn the corner. We just have to be willing to see it.
Thank you so much for joining us. For people who want to read your book, All My Bones Shake is an amazing book. It really challenges us to look at our values and our own beliefs and how they contribute or perpetuate a system of injustice and what can we do about it. So how can people access your book?
Well, the easiest way to find me, if you have access to a computer, is just to Google my name, Robert Jensen, and the first page that comes up will be mine.
Thank you again for joining us.
Great to be with you, Sylvia. Thanks.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.